It's business time, baby.
You are listening to Solo Monster Sounds Off.
It's such good shit.
Mama Monster
conquered the street.
We like fighting a woman.
What is with this company's obsession with ninjas?
Oh my God, we're only an hour in. We have two more hours of this.
Come over here and fight me.
Too many ninjas.
You haven't been beat up properly.
Who writes this stuff? Bruce?
Welcome to episode 670 of the Solo Monster Sounds Off here for Sunday, September 20th, 2020. I am the Solo Monster. This week's Sound Off sponsored in part by Audible.com. You can use our Audible link to get one free audiobook of your choosing when you use the link audibletrial.com/Solo Monster. Get yourself one free book courtesy of the Sound Off, but you guys already knew that. Delayed the start of the recording here of this podcast by probably a couple of hours, so that I can get in night two of the G1 climax. Yes, it is that time of year. The G1 is now underway. Saw night one, wanted to make sure I could get night two in before I recorded here, and I'm glad I did. Oh, am I glad I did. We're going to talk some G1 here for a few minutes in just a little bit. And of course, all the WWE news of the week, AEW news, a lot of rumors about Ricochet that did not sit very well with him. There's news of a potential return to WWE television as soon as this week, in fact. Something else that has been denied by the party in question, although I do put a lot of faith in that news. We'll get into that. Stuff on Ivelisse and Thunder Rosa, some controversy coming out of Dynamite this past week. So we'll get into all that. But I want to show some love for all of our PayPal supporters who came out full force, as they do every week, and I gotta give them their just due here at the beginning. If you want to make a PayPal donation, you can always do so on thesolomonster.com. Completely your choice, up to you. It's on the right-hand side of the page. You see that little button, you click that, and you can take it from there. $10 or more will get you a nickname and a shout-out. And if there is some kind of message you want to include in that field, if there is no notes field, some people say there is, some people there isn't, but you could always email me and let me know that way. Thank you to the Portland pop star, Paul Hamilton. Deadpool, James Herrera. The Florida Freebird, Brian Becerra. Out of Control, Cody Thomas. Raymond the Mountie Medina. Beast Mode, Brock Joseph. Killshot, Keith Hart. Fast Blast, Tim Banks. A lot of old school names here. I love seeing this. I love seeing it. That's how I know they're keeping up with the show after all these years. I see a lot of old names. The Chicago Slayer, Willie Eichard. Stephen Handyman Halistick, who, staying true to the gimmick, when he wins the championship, he does not wear a title belt. I'd like to think he wears a custom tool belt made to wear around his waist. That's part of his gimmick. Hi, I'm Chris Evans. The Diamond Dallas Dance Machine, Harrison Soep. D-Venom John Eru. Josh the Shooter Stockton. New York Punk. Arnold Modesto. Night Stalker Naif Al-Safar. Ostentatious Alan Carter, Command and Conquer, Ian Martin, who is shipping off to parts unknown soon. So as I told him in his email, safe travels, and the podcast will be here waiting for you when you get back. Stormy Skies, Ryan Spies, the Fire Bomber, Craig Foster, Guardian Angel, Jacob Donnelly, the Oak Ridge Oracle, David Lozano, Your Ass is Toast, Yavani Zarate, first-time donator. Also, I did see Yavani, though, pop up on the Dynamite stream with the Super Chats on Wednesday. And Sepia Prince. What's going on, Sepia? We'll see if I can teach you another new word this week. And one last shout here to Monado Boy, Sebastian Delgado. His father, Carlos, has a birthday coming up this Tuesday, the 22nd, and is celebrating 41 years of wedded bliss to Sebastian's mom, Elizabeth. He says his father does not watch much wrestling, only when he makes him. Well, if you're a good son, I hope that part of that is not making him watch Monday Night Raw. That might be a reason enough to disown you. Make him watch the G1. I think he'd enjoy himself. But he wanted to give them both a shout out, and I was happy to accommodate him. You know, I've got a lot of people who don't watch wrestling anymore, they listen to this show instead. So maybe we can convert Carlos into a new listener. Hey, stranger things have happened. We've got listeners of all stripes, All different situations, all different age groups. So anyway, happy birthday to him and happy anniversary as well. If you missed it, and I know we have a lot of fans of the podcast who are fans of the RSPW Rewind segment, which has moved to video on the YouTube channel. If you did not see the latest installment, which technically is episode 33, it is the 33rd installment of RSPW Rewind that I've ever done. It is up on the YouTube channel right now, went up a couple of days ago, over 30 minutes worth. It's a good one. Cover a lot of ground going all the way back to 1990, which I think might be the oldest post I've ever found. I'm going to see if I can find any older ones. I think I've exhausted most of the older ones that are still available. I wish there were more available, but not all of them are. So you kind of take what you can get. But everywhere from 1990 to 1999, I think that's the ground we covered this week. So head on over to the YouTube channel and definitely give that a watch. Give that a like, if you would be so kind while you are there. So the 30th annual G1 Climax is underway. It was delayed this year. Normally it takes place over the summer, starts in July, culminates in August. When they thought they were going to get the Olympics, though, in Japan, they had to delay the start of the G1. Little did we know the pandemic would hit, there would be no Olympics. And so the G1 was already pushed back, and so that's why it's getting a late start this year. The best tournament in wrestling anywhere every year is the G1 Climax. Now, it just started. I know not everybody has had a chance to watch both of the two opening shows yet. So I'm warning you now. If you don't want any spoilers, there are going to be spoilers here. If you do not want to be spoiled in the G1, you haven't had a chance to catch up, skip ahead. So that's my only warning to you. There will be spoilers here for night one and night two, which just ended a few hours ago. Now, on the Dynamite stream Wednesday night, I got I think it was a super chat. Somebody had written in and given me his picks for who he thought might win the G1. It might have been Dried Chicken Without Flavor, if I'm not mistaken. And I was kind of ribbing him a little bit because he said his picks, he picked like four possible winners and four possible dark horses. I said, why don't you just pick everybody? If you just pick everybody, you can't be wrong. I said, you got to narrow it down. You can have one pick and then one dark horse. You can't be picking three and four and five people who are going to win the damn thing. My pick to win the G1 this year is Okada. I'm going with Okada to win. My dark horse is Sonata. So those are my picks. We'll see, I guess, in the next couple of weeks how things shake out. Japanese commentary only for this. I don't know when Kevin Kelly is doing the English dubs. I think he had said that they were going to try to, you know, get the English commentary for most or maybe all of the shows, but it wouldn't be right away. I'm fine with the Japanese commentary. I know it bothers some people. And frankly, it's not even that it necessarily bothers them, but they really enjoy the English commentary with Kevin Kelly and Chris Charlton, and they do a great job. Probably the best commentary team in wrestling at the moment when they're working together. But the Japanese commentary doesn't bother me at all. I love their enthusiasm. I have no idea what they're saying, but I love their enthusiasm. I love the highs and the lows and the peaks and the valleys of their commentary. I actually find it rather soothing. I don't know that I could say that about any other commentary booth in wrestling, but it does not bother me. So just running through some of the results here. Will Ospreay. Will Ospreay has had a lot of controversy dogging him now for a while, coming out of the speaking out movement. Nothing that he himself is accused of outside of defending a best friend of his who was alleged to have done some really horrible things, and then trying to get this female wrestler blackballed. There were people who came forward to corroborate her story. There were emails. There was some evidence that came out. It does not paint Will Ospreay in a very good light. This is something that's not going to go away. This is going to follow him around. I know he completely deactivated his Twitter, which honestly for him is probably the best thing, to just get the hell off social media. So there's going to be a lot of conflicting opinion about Ospreay, and there really is no defense, frankly, for what he is alleged to have done. But he is in the tournament. He is in this tournament. He has bulked up in his time off during the pandemic. So you can see how he's added pounds of muscle. I don't know how much heavier he is now. He's probably a good 10 to 15 pounds heavier than he was pre-pandemic. But he looked good. He got a win here over Yujiro Takahashi. Jeff Cobb. There's been stories recently about Jeff Cobb not signing with AEW, even though they tried to bring him in. They made an offer. He is said to have turned down deals from AEW and Ring of Honor. But has not come out. Nobody's come out and actually said, I don't think, that he signed with New Japan. It's sort of implied. Him working here, I think this is where he wanted to be. So I assume that means he is signed here. He looked good. He had a match with Tai Chi. I'm surprised that Cobb took the loss. Tai Chi won. But I thought Cobb looked good. And then we get to my favorite match from night one. Taking nothing away from the main event, but this was my favorite match. And you know, one day, I feel like one day, I'm going to be sitting here, and I'm going to watch one of these G1 tournaments, and I'm going to see Minoru Suzuki in the ring, and I'm going to think, man, he aged a lot. He's moving around a lot slower in there. It's really noticeable. I miss the Suzuki of old. Well, thank God now is not that time. This was a fantastic battle between Minoru Suzuki and the Stone Pitbull, Tomohiro Ishii, that Suzuki won with the Gotch pile driver. You should just watch it yourself if you can find it, if you're subscribed to New Japan World, what have you. Make sure you check this match out. Suzuki is, I don't know what to say about this guy. He's a phenom. He really is. The match he had with Shingo, where he won the Never Openweight title only a few weeks ago, was just amazing. This guy is great. I love his matches. I love his work. And nobody pulls off that scary, you know, take a shit in your pants look. if you're watching this guy, if this guy was chasing you in a dark alley, but yet you see him outside the ring, you know, the few times I've seen like video of him on, I feel like I've seen him on like some Japanese game shows or some kind of other show. Like he comes off as the nicest guy in the world, but when, you know, he's working, that's a different story. But he looks like a pro wrestler. He looks like a scary dude you would not want to find yourself opposite from in the ring. He's great. He's absolutely fantastic. And he got the win. Jay White got a win over Shingo Takagi. I'm not a fan of the interference and the bullshit and get, you know, and I understand Jay White is a heel. It's his shtick. It's what he does. It's what Ghetto does. He gets involved. But just was not a fan of it here. White hit a low blow. Red Shoes had gotten bumped. He rolled back into the ring. And Jay White hit the Blade Runner and picked up the win. And I think this was Jay White's first match back. There was a series of wrestlers. Jay White, Ospreay, Juice Robinson, I think, was another that have really not seen any action because of the pandemic. They weren't able to travel. And now they got these guys back. So the roster has now been bolstered because they've gotten a whole bunch of people back that they didn't have over the last few months. I think Jay White was one of those people. And last year's G1 Climax winner, Kota Ibushi, picked up a win over Kazuchika Okada. Very good main event on night one. Ibushi gets his win back after losing to Okada on Wrestle Kingdom night one, what feels like 20 years ago at this point. It was only 9 months ago. Feels like 20 years. This has been the longest year ever. And it's not over yet. But this has felt like the absolute longest year ever. This was not a Tokyo Dome classic, but it felt like an abbreviated version of what could have been one of them. The Bomae Niba Ibushi followed up by the Kamigoye for the win. So Ibushi gets his win back. It would be topped. This match would be topped the very next night. Or I guess I should say this morning. Night two ended earlier this morning. I delayed the start of this podcast so that I could at least watch part of it or most of the matches. And I definitely wanted to see the main event. And I'm glad I did. And again, I reiterate, spoilers here. So skip ahead if you have not had a chance to watch the matches and you care. If you don't care, then that's great. But if you do care, you have been warned. I mentioned Juice Robinson a moment ago. They have Juice back. Juice has changed up his look. He is dressed now like Deuce and Domino or something. I don't know, something straight out of a Blues Brothers movie. He beat Yoshihashi in a good match. Very good match, even. Maybe better than I expected. So he gets himself on the board early. I always smile when I see Juice Robinson because I just think back to his days as CJ Parker in NXT doing the whole hippie environmentalist gimmick that they had him doing, walking around with the signs, and everybody used to talk him up. I mean, Kevin Owens to this day will talk this guy up as being one of the best in the business and one of the best promos and underrated and underappreciated. I know they became very good friends during his time in NXT. But here's a guy who just wanted more. He wanted more, and so he left and went to Japan and has turned himself... I mean, he's just completely changed his entire career. And he seems to be having a ball. He seems to be enjoying himself. He's committed himself, you know, full-time to New Japan. And it just goes to show you, you know, some guys... You know, some guys are content to settle. Some people go to WWE and they see the bright lights and, oh my God, it's WWE. And maybe they're not happy with how they're being used, but maybe they're getting paid well and they're in the biggest promotion in the world and they're content. Maybe they don't want to travel. Maybe they don't want to go live in Japan, but they're content to just kind of maintain the status quo. And here's a guy who wasn't. He goes, I want to be doing more. I want to improve. I want to get better. I want to up my game. Maybe one day he'll be back. But you can tell just watching him. This guy's having a blast. Yano and Sonata. It is the G1. And so you know what to expect with Yano. I know Yano is... I was going to make a comparison with Yano and R-Truth. I mean, they're both comedy characters. I like R-Truth, actually. I just don't like a lot of the 24/7 bullshit, which is completely played out. The Yano stuff with me, it never gets old. I enjoy it. Maybe it's because I don't have to see it every week on TV. You know, if we saw the Yano stuff every single week on TV, like the way they do TV here in this country, I would be completely sick of it. It would be totally played out. But I don't know. I find it charming in a way. He had a spray bottle before the match started. He had a spray bottle. He made sure the referee put his hands out. He was spraying the referee with hand sanitizer before the referee could feel around and check for any foreign objects. And the referee found two rolls of tape, one tucked under each of Yano's knee pads. And then later during the match, Sonata had him, I think, in a, I don't know, he had his arms wrapped around Yano and he could feel something. He told the referee and the referee checked. The referee reached into Yano's tights and he pulled out another roll of tape. I don't know where he finds the places to put all of this tape, but he does. This didn't go very long. Sonata tied up Yano in the aisle with the Paradise Lock. One of the Young Lions helped free Yano, which pissed off Sonata, and so he tries to put him in the Paradise Lock. Yano, though, while this is going on, unbeknownst to Sonata, Yano busts out one more roll of tape that went undetected, and he ties the two of them together by the leg. And Yano sprints back into the ring before the 20 count. Sonata is trying to, like a bunny rabbit, he's trying to hop back into the ring. He's got this guy literally attached to his leg, and he cannot make it down the aisle back into the ring in time. And that means that Yano picks up the count-out victory. Sonata has been Yano'd. Not a good start for my dark horse pick here in the G1. They took an extended break at this point to clean and disinfect the ring. I believe they had 50% capacity for both shows. They had a lot of fans in the building. I mean, they didn't have too many wide shots where you can see. There were some camera angles that they would have where you could kind of tell, like up in the bleachers and whatnot, they weren't packed. But you would just watch this show, and what you were seeing in those first several rows, you would think the place was totally packed. But I think it was half capacity. And they're still largely clapping. They're not making as much noise as they normally would because they've asked people, please don't shout. We don't want particles, even though you're wearing masks, we don't want particles flying around. We're trying to be safe. And so people aren't making as much noise. They're doing a lot of clapping. But I'll tell you what, you know, watching this felt to me as close to normal as any wrestling show has felt since March. It just kind of, I wasn't really thinking about the crowd too much. It just sort of felt like they had a packed crowd and they're making noise and they're back in these regular buildings and they're taking whatever precautions that they need to take. These intermissions they do in the middle are kind of long, but they're there for a reason. So then we come back. We had Kenta taking on Hirooki Goto, tapping him out. Kenta kept going for his Umaplata crossface. I think he calls it game over. Over and over and over he's going for this move. Finally, though, at the end, he got it locked on. And Goto had no place to go. He was forced to tap. I thought this was good, but it wasn't very exciting. It was good. That's the best I can say about it. We had Zack Sabre Jr. and Evil The announcers went crazy for the finish here. Again, couldn't understand a word they were saying, but they were going nuts. Dick Togo jumped up on the apron. Sabre knocked him off. Evil sent Sabre into Red Shoes. So again, Red Shoes, poor Red Shoes. We're only two nights in. He gets bumped. Not his first bump here in this tournament. Togo jumps back in. He attacks Zack Sabre Jr. When Red Shoes finally comes to a few minutes later, Evil hits Darkness Falls, only gets a two count. He goes for Everything Is Evil, but Sabre blocks it and he rolls into a European clutch. This was quite the counter. He rolls into a European clutch and he gets the pin. That was a cool finish. And it came off like a major upset, which it is. I mean, to me anyway, it is. It's a major upset for a man who just had a run for several months as the IWGP and the IWGP Intercontinental Champion to be beaten on a finish like that. So I enjoyed that finish. I thought that was very well done. And then we come to Tetsuya Naito against Hiroshi Tanahashi in the main event. I was surprised to find out that this was their first meeting in 3 years. The first singles match between these two men in 3 years. Naito regained both belts. He is the champion. He regained both belts from Evil at their Summer Struggle event, which was just a few weeks ago. Tanahashi, he has not had a great year. He has only one singles win all year. And that was back in January. Because he's been more focused, I mean, the pandemic, obviously, but since they've been back, he's been more focused on the tag team titles and the tag team division and his team with Kota Ibushi. But I was, you know, it's kind of shocking, you know, to find out here we are in September, it's G1 time, and Tanahashi has one singles win all year. He also has more G1 matches than any man in history, does Hiroshi Tanahashi. This was a fantastic match, probably the best New Japan match since the Wrestle Kingdom shows at the beginning of the year, and this was up there with those matches as well. This was one of the best matches from any promotion all year. I love this match. Tanahashi, he did a tremendous high fly flow at one point early on to a standing Naito on the floor. So we skip ahead when things kicked up into the next gear. Tanahashi hit a pair of sling blades, headed up top for the high fly flow. He hit a standing high fly flow, went right back up to the top. He was going to finish him off with another one. Naito rolled out of the way. Tanahashi crashed and burned. Naito hits the Destino. Tanahashi kicks out at two. Naito goes for another Destino. Tanahashi blocks it. But Naito blocked the palm strike, landed one final Destino for the win. This went longer than the main event on night one. But this was a better match and just a fantastic wrestling match. And I'll tell you what, I think the pandemic, the time off that they all had, coupled with Tanahashi spending more time in the tag team ranks, not really having any of these big kind of epic singles matches. All of these things have probably done Tanahashi's body a world of good. You know, any nagging injuries he may have had. You know, he's in his early 40s now. He's had a lot of injuries, a lot of wear and tear on his knees and on his body. And for a lot of these guys, I would imagine the one kind of shining light in the time off that they had was being able to heal up any nagging injuries. Because these guys, they just go and they go and they go and they rarely take time off for these injuries. I remember Ishii a few years ago had, I don't remember exactly what the injury was, but he had a pretty serious shoulder injury and he just wore tape on it and he never took time off. I mean, that's just what these guys do. So now for a period of whatever it was, 3-4 months, they were forced to take time off. And I think it probably did a world of good for a lot of them. And Tanahashi is one of those people. But this match got me amped up. Watching this early on a Sunday morning here, before I hit the record button here, this got me amped up. So the next shows are Wednesday and Thursday. I'm going to try to follow as much of the tournament this year as I can. Maybe not every show, but as many of them as I can, as many main events as I can. Because the G1, honestly, it really is the most fun. It's the best tournament, but it's the most fun period of wrestling. Every year, from any promotion, anywhere in the world, is the G1 climax. And even if you're not a big New Japan fan, and you don't know all the wrestlers and the characters, whatever words you want to use, if you were to check out some of the G1, I think you would enjoy it. It is a lot of fun. We got more spoilers here, this time on a WWE return. Someone who could be showing up as soon as tomorrow night, depending on which brand they end up on. So if you want to be surprised, you have been warned. PW Insider reports that Melina Perez has signed a deal to return to WWE, yet another piece of the NWA being chipped away. The last we saw of Melina, she was on NWA Power. She had an alliance going. It was a bit frayed, but she had an alliance going for a while with Thunder Rosa and Marty Bell. Her last WWE appearance was last summer on the Raw reunion show that they did. But before that, she had really had not been with the company full-time. She had not been signed with the company since 2011. So we're talking almost a decade. A long time has gone by. They wanted her for the Women's Royal Rumble earlier this year, but her deal with the NWA prevented that from happening. Well, now that deal has obviously expired, and she is said to be back with WWE. Although, according to Melina herself, that is not the case. She posted a long statement on her Facebook page. She was very upset by the report, and this is what, in part, I'm not going to reproduce the whole thing, but this is part of what she had to say. She said, "This makes my heart ache because I love the fans so much. I want you to realize that these websites that claim they know what's happening don't. How many times have they falsely reported things about me and said that I am returning?" Let me stop there. I have no idea what website she's referring to that have put reports out about Melina returning. I would love for her to tell me what these websites are. Any of what I consider to be the reputable sites have not said anything about Melina returning other than when she came back to the NWA. That turned out to be true. So again, I have no idea what she's talking about there. She says, "You can't believe them because they do not report real or correct news. They often twist things up to get clicks. I am not signed with WWE, but that does not mean that it's not a possibility. My reason for this post is that it bothers me that these sites lie to the fans. If I potentially get signed, don't forgive them for lying to you. I know there are those that aren't a fan of mine, but I still will care about them as I do my own fans. I don't like when people lie to you and or bring your hopes up. You deserve better than that. You should demand better than that. They think it's okay to pull these stunts because you'll still follow or click that link. You should follow sites that don't treat you like you're stupid and do not lie to you. It seems like a lot of wrestling news sites do that, though." First of all, where do I even begin here? I saw a lot of people dragging Dave Meltzer. They were dragging Dave Meltzer's name into this. Oh, another false Meltzer report, not realizing what these dipshits did not realize. Is that this was not a Dave Meltzer report. In fact, it wasn't until yesterday that I even saw anything on the Observer site that mentioned Melina at all. And that was just to cite the PW Insider report, which is where this originated from. It was Mike Johnson on PWInsider.com. These people are so obsessed. Meltzer is living rent-free in their heads. They're so obsessed with Meltzer. They just attribute everything to him. Every wrestling report is attributed to Dave Meltzer. So that's number one. Second of all, this reminds me of another story that Mike Johnson broke, which turned out to be accurate. Someone Melina knows very well, John Morrison, who Mike Johnson reported. This was about a year ago, in fact. It might have been a year ago this month. Mike Johnson reported that John Morrison had signed to return to WWE. And what did Morrison do? Morrison came out on Twitter and he denied the report and he mocked Mike Johnson for reporting it. He's very snarky about it. Only for WWE to then make the announcement themselves 3 months later. Now, is it possible that at that exact moment, Morrison was not pen to paper signed? That there were discussions, maybe there was an informal agreement, but the actual contract had not yet been signed? Yeah, I mean, I suppose that is possible. But yes, I'm just trying to give him the benefit of the doubt and not look at John Morrison and say the guy was just being a dick. Maybe pen was not put to paper at that point, but again, Johnson heard it from multiple people. He stuck to his report. He never took it back. And he said, no, yeah, despite what he says, he is signed. He is coming back. And it's just a matter of when WWE makes the announcement. And lo and behold, WWE made the announcement. In fact, that's probably why Morrison decided to come out, because the cat was out of the bag. And WWE wanted to be the ones to break the news. But that's exactly what this reminded me of. You know, I get that these people don't want to let the cat out of the bag too early, but Mike Johnson does not get paid to get scoops and then bury them so that somebody else from some other website can beat him to the punch. Because what would the point of that even be? There are people who pay for subscriptions to PW Insider and similar websites, not because if they get news, we want them to suppress it and not tell us, because some people are going to be very upset. Oh, we want it to be a surprise. Hey, I miss surprises as much as the next guy. But that's not how the world fucking works. The guy is doing his job. He gets news. What does he do? He verifies it with one, two, three, sometimes four different sources. On this story, he said that he confirmed it with multiple people within WWE that Melina has signed to come back. So if he is saying that he has confirmed the news with multiple parties within the company, not just one person, then I believe him. Melina is back with WWE. She may be upset the news got out early, but hey, that's life. Now, as far as her being back, I think the women's division on SmackDown probably would be the best landing spot for her. Probably more than Raw. I think they could use a new face there. And she was a star at one time. She was never the cream of the crop in the women's division, but she had star power. She was a star on the show. And so there may be some value in adding her to the women's division there. I recognize that she had star power, but I also recognize that there's a lot of talent they have already in the company on the main roster not being used. There's a lot of talent they have down in NXT, female talent, that should probably be on Raw or SmackDown right now. Now, maybe that ends up not being such a good thing for them when they do get called up, but they already have a lot of talent. The issue is not that they lack the talent. The issue is that they don't fucking know what to do with the talent that they have. And I'm going to get into that in a little bit, too, when it comes to Zelina Vega now being slotted as the new number one contender, when you've got Bianca Belair and these other people who don't even make appearances on TV because these people don't know what the fuck they're doing. Maybe they should focus a little bit more on the people they do have and actually getting them on TV and trying to build them up as stars instead of bringing back people from 10 or 15 years ago. So that would be my comment on the issue. Monday Night Raw. Monday Night Raw this past week, they loaded the show up more than usual to compete with Monday Night Football. And, you know, if it worked, then all it did was it kept more people from tuning out as they brought in just shy of 1.7 million viewers on Monday night. That is down 26% from the same week last year. I'm going to assume that's the same week Monday Night Football restarted. Otherwise, that would be a little bit skewed. But it just goes to the pattern I've been talking about for years now. Year over year, you'll have weeks where the number goes up, the number goes down. One week, it might actually hit 1.5 million one day, and people are going to be declaring doom and gloom for WWE. And then the next week, it'll be back up to 1.8. You know, the numbers ping-pong and ricochet back and forth so many times. All you need to do is look at the numbers year over year. Especially since Raw went to 3 hours in 2012. Every single year, down, 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 down. And that's the number that has to be the most concerning. 26% from last year to this year. Now, as an update on Ivar's injury, remember Ivar, I mentioned him last week, the dive through the ropes and the injury he sustained. Unfortunately, it is a serious enough injury that he had to undergo neck surgery. I have not heard what kind of neck surgery, if that's spinal fusion, if it's some other kind of neck surgery, if it was a herniated disc. Neck surgery, regardless, is a serious injury. It's a serious surgery, and it's going to keep him out of action for a very long time. It's very possible that we may not see Ivar again for over a year. It is a serious injury. I would not want to be Eric right now. And that's also one less tag team now that they have available to them in the tag team division. A tag team division that appears to be all but dead. It was already dead even with the Viking Raiders. Now without the Viking Raiders, it's even more dead. For the second week in a row, Michael Cole sat in for Tom Phillips. So something is going on with Tom. I have no idea. I'm not going to even speculate on what it could be, but that's something I'm sure the company, you know, would not want anybody to know if it did have something to do with COVID or whatever. That's the first thing I thought of. But there's been no reports. There's been no news on it. So we have no idea. But I'll say this. No one misses two straight weeks of TV in this company unless something is wrong. Samoa Joe, he was also out this week. That was the first Raw that he missed. So we got Michael Cole with Byron Saxton and Dolph Ziggler sitting in for the first half of the show. Ziggler headed to the underground later on, so he left. But when he did, they had MVP step in and do commentary for the last half or so of the show. Drew McIntyre, he pitched an ambulance match for Clash of Champions, which is now 1 week away. We have another pay-per-view coming up next Sunday. It is Clash of Champions. He pitched an ambulance match for he and Randy Orton. Adam Pearce said that Randy Orton may not be able to make it to Clash of Champions. And if he cannot, there was a match in the main event between Drew McIntyre and Keith Lee. And he said that if Keith Lee could beat Drew McIntyre, then he would get the championship shot instead if Orton was unable to compete. Keep in mind that Adam Pearce has gotten more television time on these shows than Mustafa Ali has. Just remember that. The Street Profits beat Cesaro and Shinsuke Nakamura clean in the Battle of the Brands. At least we finally got to see Montez Ford and Angelo Dawkins in there with somebody not named Andrade or Angel Garza for a change. But we may not be done with that just yet. WWE has announced a triple threat match for Raw tomorrow night. It will be Andrade and Angel Garza, Dominic Mysterio, and Humberto Carrillo. He is back. He's been dwelling on main event for a while. He's back on Raw. Humberto, look at this. Humberto is back. Another one of those Paul Heyman projects that got pushed to the side. When Paul Heyman got pushed to the side, you could just watch the show. You can kind of tell who Paul Heyman's favorites were. So Dominic and Humberto are going to be a team. And the third team, Seth Rollins and Murphy. So there's going to be a triple threat. The winning team will challenge the Street Profits for the tag team titles at Clash of Champions. That sounds like a win either for Garza and Andrade, which gives us the same fucking match that we've been seeing now for what feels like 3 months, or a win for Rollins and Murphy to put a heel team up against Ford and Dawkins. To illustrate how bankrupt the tag team division is right now, three potential challengers lined up in this triple threat tomorrow night, exactly none of which are regular teams. I don't consider Garza, and I know they've been teaming for a little while now, but I still don't consider Garza and Andrade a regular team. It's two singles guys that were mushed together. They're already building dissension for the breakup. They're not a real team. Three teams in this match, none of which are actual real tag teams. And it just illustrates my point even more about why these titles need to be merged. I cannot believe that they beat the SmackDown Tag Team Champions in a non-title match and they're not running the match on SmackDown this week with Cesaro and Nakamura getting their win back. Even Steven, 50-50. And then doing a unification match at the pay-per-view. One of the only times you'll ever hear me advocating for 50-50 booking here. I can't believe it. Can't believe they didn't do that. That is absolutely the match that I would do at Clash of Champions to unify the belts. And instead, they're just moving on from it. They had the match inexplicably. They just had the match randomly 1 week. The Raw champions won, and that's it. It's over. They've already announced Cesaro and Nakamura are defending their SmackDown Tag Team titles next Sunday against the Lucha House Party, which has kickoff match written all over it. The Hurt Business continues to be the best thing on Monday Night Raw. I am impressed with how they've built these four up so far, especially with what happened at the end of the show. Cedric Alexander got a win on this show over Ricochet. There are a few things more fun to watch at wrestling outside of the G1 than Ricochet selling any big move, but Ricochet selling a lumbar check, that was a thing of beauty. The Hurt Business celebration right after was interrupted by another Retribution promo This time, they name-dropped the Performance Center, so they kind of gave us a clue about who they are, even though we already knew. They were from the PC, they were from NXT, we already knew this. They talked about being the product of empty promises, lies, and betrayal. They once believed their time at the PC would lead to fame and fortune, but they refused to suck up. So now we have a sense of story, at least. They felt that they were going to be called up, and when they weren't, I mean, that's what I took away from this. When they weren't, they just decided to take matters into their own hands. Is that really a reason to be angry and destroy things, destroy property? If I was spared a call-up to Monday Night Raw, I'd be cutting promos thanking these people. Have they watched the show recently? I'd send them a fucking gift basket. Speaking of Ricochet, you know, Melina got very upset by internet reports. Although, again, that was, in my view, a credible report. Ricochet got upset over rumors that he is looking to leave WWE. And this really has nothing to do with any wrestling news websites. What happened is the rumors started after a tweet. Tweet that was posted by the WrestleVotes account saying, I cannot reveal the name, as that is just not smart business, but I can very confidently say that a certain WWE talent has decided not to re-sign with the company once their current deal expires. Now, WrestleVotes, while it is not a website, has proven reliable in the past. WrestleVotes has put forth scoops that have come true. But it is a vague tweet that someone may be leaving soon. Anybody can post a tweet like that. I could post a tweet like that. And what it does is it gets people speculating, which isn't fair to someone like Ricochet. If he's telling the truth, now he feels like he has to come out and defend himself so that it doesn't get back to the company. It doesn't get back to his employer that he's headed for the exit as soon as his contract is up. Even though it might give him more leverage, but that's beside the point. But Ricochet took to Twitter. And again, WrestleVotes never said anything about Ricochet. It was everybody else speculating. They were looking at the people on the roster and who's being used, who's not being used, who might be unhappy. And people just sort of ran with it on their own. Ricochet took to Twitter. He said, where the hell did these rumors start? I've never said once that I am leaving to anyone. So for these dirt sheets out there, maybe fact check before you just blast some trash on your website for clicks. Now, there may have been some of these lower rung websites that put stuff out on Ricochet after the fact. That might have come after the fact. And I have a feeling I know what sites they probably were, which, you know, we won't speak of them. I'm not going to feed into this and speculate on who it is, on who it might be, until there is something more solid from another source. But I will say this. If anyone would benefit from getting the hell out of there, and I think this is why people started throwing his name around, it is Ricochet. He may not be a great promo. And I know in WWE that's kind of important. You got to be able to talk. That is not his strong suit. But he has got more talent in his pinky finger than most people have in their entire body. I've described him before as basically a walking video game character. That is the best way I can describe Ricochet. He is a walking video game character. He is probably the epitome of everybody who criticizes flippy wrestling and flippy wrestlers. Yes, that is Ricochet. But he does it better than anybody. He's a very, I would say once in a lifetime performer, but he's kind of in that upper echelon of guys who can go in there and do things that you just watch and you say to yourself, a human being should not be able to do the things that he is able to do. And that is the reputation that he had built up for himself working on the independent scene, working in Lucha Underground and all the places that he has been. And to see the way that he has been utilized in WWE, if you are a Ricochet fan, I don't see how you can be happy and not be begging for him to get the hell out of there. Because the other thing about a guy who does the things that Ricochet can do, those skills are going to wane the older he gets. So every year that goes by on that contract, every year that goes by, there are certain things that he's able to do that he ain't going to be able to do anymore. He is wasting his prime years away in WWE. And look, if it's just about the money, then hey, take the money and run. You earned yourself a contract with WWE. For a lot of people, that's all it's about. Just get that contract with WWE. Get that. I say job security, but we all know that doesn't exist. You can sign a fucking 15-year contract with this company. It don't matter. They snap their fingers like Thanos and you're gone. There ain't no such thing as job security in WWE. But if that's what it's about, if it's about the money and it's about, then great. Then I guess he's achieved what he wanted to achieve. I can't get in his head. I don't know what he's thinking. I don't know what's most important to him. Is it the craft? Is it the money? Is it working with different people? Is it getting on TV? Is it fame and fortune? I don't know. I don't know what's going through his mind. And I'm sure he is making good money doing what he does. But is this really how he envisioned spending the next 2, 3, 5 years of his career? I don't think so. So if he does choose to leave, I will not blame him at all. And he would be just fine. Because he will have promotions from here to Mexico to Japan to Timbuktu. Trying to grab this guy. It will not be long before Ricochet land. Maybe New Japan again. It will not be long before Ricochet would land somewhere if he were to leave WWE. But the Ricochet that we see in the ring 5 years from now is going to look very different than the Ricochet that we see today. He's just not going to be able to do the things that he does forever. He will have to change his style. He will have to adapt. He will have to slow things down a little bit. But he should be killing it right now. And instead of killing it, he has been killed. He had a better run under a mask as Prince Puma than he's had in WWE. I would like to see Ricochet get the hell out of there the first chance he gets. Asuka. She defended her Raw Women's Championship against Mickie James. This match was not as good as their TakeOver Toronto match a few years ago. Mickie seemed a little off. Some of her moves looked like she was in quicksand. I don't know. This was not what I was hoping it would be, and that was before the finish. Asuka trapped her in the Asuka lock, and James kind of floated over either to get out of it or try to pin Asuka's shoulders to the mat. It looked like it was a cover, and the referee should have been counting. I was wondering why he wasn't, unless he saw one of the shoulders was up. Instead, he just called for the bell and announced that due to Mickie being unable to continue, Asuka was the winner. And that told me, okay, maybe there's an injury. Maybe he thinks that she's concussed. Because otherwise, why would he announce that because she can't continue? It would have been easy enough for him to call for the bell and just, like Montreal, you know, just say that she tapped out, even though she didn't. So once they said that she wasn't able to continue, I thought that they assumed injury, that they saw something that we couldn't see. Because she didn't look hurt. She wasn't selling an injury. She really didn't even look that out of it. And as soon as the match was ended, her eyes got wide. She had this look on her face like, what the fuck are you doing? I guess Mickie just did such a good job of selling, they thought that she might have actually been hurt. She might have been out on her feet. But it looks like they're going to try to play this up now for storyline purposes. Mickie gave an interview to TalkSport out of the UK. And said that she understands they thought she was hurt, and they did what they felt they had to do, but let's be honest, she said it's not a real loss. What can I do except go in there and throw a fit on Monday? I'm all for the return of Psycho Mickie James. I don't think that's what she was getting at here, but I do miss Psycho Mickie from all those years ago. If we get some of that Mickie James back, I'm all for it. Zelina Vega came out right after. So Mickie just rolls out to the floor. And the referee goes out there. And now I'm thinking, okay, he's checking on an injury. Well, while that's going on, it almost felt like, okay, we got to do something. Let's just send Zelina out. I assume this was the plan all along. But it kind of felt like maybe it was inaudible and they just had to send somebody out there. But out comes Zelina Vega to confront Asuka. That looks to be the match for Clash of Champions next Sunday. Which is not only completely random, because Zelina Vega has done nothing to earn a championship match. She has done nada. Not only that, but it is completely ridiculous that they had a ready-made program with Asuka and Shayna Baszler that has now been abandoned. Not because they probably wanted to do something with Shayna Baszler, but it's been abandoned because they needed something for Nia Jax to do. So now they're the tag team champions. Hey, at least Shayna has a belt. At least she's on TV, she's got a position, good for her. But they had a ready-made program ready to go with those two, and they abandoned it. And they have Bianca Belair. When was the last time we saw Bianca Belair on Monday Night Raw? The woman never appears on TV. She might be on Main Event, but she ain't on Raw. And yet they go with Zelina Vega, who is better off as a manager. She's great in that role. But these other people that they're it's like they don't know what they're doing. It's pathetic. It is pathetic. We had a steel cage match between Seth Rollins and Dominic Mysterio with the entire Mysterio family at ringside watching. And they turned in another very good match. By the way, I was corrected by a fan of the podcast during my Dynamite stream on Wednesday night, who trains with Dominic. He pointed out that Dominic, because I've talked before about Dominic at the PC and almost like giving them credit because he's very good for someone with at his age, with his level of experience. But this person pointed out to me that Dominic does not train at the Performance Center. He trains out of the Level Up Pro Wrestling School, I guess it is, in San Diego. The head trainer there is B-Boy. That's where Dominic trains. So, hey, shout out to those guys, because whoever's training Dominic has done a very good job. And I know it's in his blood already. You almost have this expectation. Hey, if you're the son of someone like Rey Mysterio, right, or Ric Flair, or any of these legends or anything, you're predisposed to it, right? You would think. I mean, not everybody is going to go on to be the kind of athlete their father was or have the same level of success their father's had. But yeah, you look at like a Charlotte Flair and some of these second, third generation stars. But even still, you got to shout out the people who were putting the work in to train him, because I think they've done a hell of a job so far. Kid's been put into a lot of big match situations in the last month wrestling. He wrestled a singles match at SummerSlam, tag team match at Payback. He's had multiple TV matches now a steel cage match. And I think he has looked good in every single one of them. Now, he's had some good dance partners. Rollins and Murphy are great people for him to share the ring with. But Dominic deserves a lot of credit as well. They crotched each other on the top rope. Dominic crawled towards the door. Ray was trying to will him over to the door, but Murphy attacked Ray. And then he swung the door. Murphy swung the door without looking. He thought it was Dominic, but it wasn't. It was Seth Rollins making his way over to the door. And so Murphy whacked him in the head with the cage door. Dominic hit a frog splash for a near fall. He tried crawling out, but Rollins hit the superplex into the Falcon Arrow. Back-to-back curb stomps for the win. After the match, Rollins slammed the cage door on Murphy's head as payback for doing the same to him. And as he walked off, he walked right past Ray's wife, Angie, and his daughter on the outside of the ring. And he said to Angie that he hopes that she did a better job of raising her daughter than she did her son. And then he walked off. So Angie walks up the steps into the cage to check on her son, as her daughter Aaliyah is walking going to walk up the steps into the cage. She pauses and she kneels down beside Murphy and puts her hand on Murphy to check, as if to check and see if he's okay. Which was interesting. Now, I don't think they're turning this into anything romantic. Ray's daughter is 19, Murphy is 32, and Ray should be smart enough to know how these things go. He's been in wrestling long enough. But that could be a tease for something else. You know, maybe she turns out to be the weak link of the family and they can use her in some way, but to me, there's absolutely no reason to keep this thing going. I say it every week. I've enjoyed the matches, but my God, I mean, how long is this going to go on for? At some point, you got to move on. How many more matches are we going to get with these guys? I guess we're getting another one tomorrow night because they're going to be part of that triple threat tag team match. So we're getting it again. Braun Strowman showed up to Raw Underground. SmackDown's Braun Strowman shows up on Monday Night Raw from being the Universal Champion only a few weeks ago to an underground fight club. The fall for Braun has been fast and hard. You guys know my thoughts on Raw Underground. It is completely unwatchable. Shout out to @RaRaRollins on Twitter. He is out here doing God's work. He watched it. He tracked the number of camera cuts during the Dolph Ziggler-Riddick Moss fight before Braun Strowman interrupted and beat up both guys. 67. Let me repeat that. There were 67 camera cuts in less than 2 minutes. And it got worse at the end of the show. Just by far, and it's not even close, the worst production of any show on television. And I don't say that lightly, because WWE's production team and the work that they've done before and the video packages and all that kind of stuff, and there's no other wrestling company that has a presentation that looks as smooth and HD, right? They've got multi-millions of dollars in equipment and television studios and all the stuff they have that other wrestling companies don't, including AEW, right? WWE has it all at their disposal, and I watch this Monday Night Raw show, and I say to myself, the worst production of any show on all of television. I have watched cable access shows that have better production than this. 67 fucking camera cuts. Unbelievable. And people think I'm joking. They think I'm exaggerating when I talk about this. That's not a big deal. What, you're exaggerating. What are you talking about? No, I'm not. No, I'm not. Watch for yourself. As long as you don't have epilepsy. Watch for yourself. And tell me if I'm lying. Unwatchable. Now later on, Braun wiped out a bunch of dudes, I know that, and then he ended up being confronted by Dabba Kato, who just dwarfed him. Dabba Kato is a gigantic man. That's Babatunde. But I guess that's his real name, right? I think that's his real name, so I guess they don't want him using his real name, because then he'll own his real name. Or will he? Maybe WWE will own it. I guess it depends on the language in the man's contract. But Shane McMahon was so excited, he could hardly contain himself. He was holding them back, telling people, go save it for next week. And so that's one of the matches they're promoting for Raw tomorrow night. On Raw Underground, it's going to be Braun Strowman against Dabba Kato. Kevin Owens, he pinned Aleister Black with a stunner after the lights began to flicker. That distracted Aleister Black. Basically, they didn't want to beat either one of these guys clean, so they went with the cheap finish. They went with a distraction-type finish. Black and Andrade are said to be two of the names, by the way, that Paul Heyman had big plans for who are not on Vince McMahon's list of favorites. You don't need a dirt sheet to tell you that, because these two, just look at the way they've been used on this show. It's obvious that they're not a priority on this show anymore. Ruby Riott and Liv Morgan, they beat Natty and Lana quickly. They pinned Lana, and then Nia Jax, who was ringside with Shayna Baszler watching Liv and Ruby, who were challenging them for the belts next Sunday. Jax gave Lana a Samoan drop through the announce desk less than a week after her husband debuted on AEW television, taking shots at the company, telling them to take their brass ring and shove it up their ass. I'm sure that this is all just one big fat coincidence. I mean, it's not like this company would be petty or anything. No. No, of course not. Never. I can never see that happening. Drew McIntyre and Keith Lee, they went to a no contest when Retribution ran out. They tried to fight them off. They were overwhelmed. Another 29 camera cuts here in 40 seconds. You can shake the camera all you want, Woody. It ain't gonna make me care about this any more or any less. You can shake, shake, shake. Shake it off like Taylor Swift. It don't make no difference to me. So with the non-finish, they're going to run the match back again tomorrow night. It's McIntyre and Lee. Same stipulation. If Lee wins and Orton can't compete at Clash of Champions, he takes his place in the ambulance match. Now, of course, Randy Orton will be at Clash of Champions. Randy Orton will probably be on Raw tomorrow night. He'll probably make a cameo and maybe do a run-in, hit somebody with an RKO. So that leaves two options. As I see it, that leaves two options. Either they add Keith Lee anyway to make it a triple threat, and I'm not even sure how one wins a triple threat ambulance match outside of, I guess, just throwing both of your opponents into the back of the ambulance, or maybe you can run them both over with the ambulance. The other option that I propose as an idea is that Retribution, again, gets involved in the main event, even if it is just flickering lights or something, but it ends up costing Keith Lee the match. Drew then goes off, as scheduled, to defend his championship next Sunday against Randy Orton. But Keith Lee, very upset and angry about the loss, throws out a challenge to Retribution. He throws out a challenge to the leader of Retribution to show up at the pay-per-view and fight him. We know Dijakovic is part of Retribution. We know this. He may well be the leader. And there's a history there with Keith Lee, so when they show up at Clash of Champions, maybe we can finally get the big reveal. And Keith Lee is shocked. He is shocked to find out that his friend is one of the people under the mask. So that could be one way for them, you know, for them to go. Because every week they keep dragging this Retribution stuff out without some kind of reveal is another week where people lose interest. We're going on almost 2 months now since they first arrived. Keith Lee is not winning the WWE Championship. So maybe it's best to just keep him out of that match if he's not going to win and just advance the Retribution storyline instead, especially if he has a personal tie-in with one of the members. And I know that we've seen Lee and Dijakovic already ad nauseum in NXT, but you know what? For the main roster, it's something new. People love to talk about how it's not the same thing. You get different fans watching different shows. Well, if that's the case, then you can do Dominik Dijakovic and Keith Lee again on the main roster. At least that we know they can have great matches together. That could be one way of putting that group and putting Dijakovic on the map. But the best part of this whole segment was when the Hurt Business came out. They walked out. They're all dressed up to the nines. Now, these guys are heels. But it didn't matter. They walked out. They didn't back down from a fight. They went right after the Ninja Nexus. They came off like a bunch of badasses here. They were defending their territory. They were defending their turf. It didn't matter if normally they're heels or, you know, they're cowardly heels. They weren't cowardly heels here. They weren't coming out to save Drew McIntyre. They weren't coming out to save Keith Lee. They were coming out to kick some ass. So it goes to what I was saying earlier. I've been impressed with how they have been portraying the Hurt Business on TV. But then Drew McIntyre and Keith Lee hit stereo dives out over the top rope onto everybody because, of course, they did. And I know some people were tweeting me, oh, I can't wait. Solomonster is going to explode on the podcast this week. See, a diving spot there in that spot actually works. Plus, you got a whole bunch of guys outside to break their fall or to catch them. It's the weekly running shove. Somebody on Twitter called it a running shove, and I just thought that was such an accurate description of what these TV dives are that we see every week. They're not even dives. They're running shoves through the ropes. That's my issue. It's the weekly running shoves that have no business on TV and need to die. They need to die a death. Leave them for the guys like Jungle Boy and Darby Allin and Ricochet, and for God's sake, stop doing the running dives, the running shoves. That's where I have an issue. But in a spot like this, like if we didn't get dives most weeks on TV, people probably would have looked at that as being an even bigger deal. Even these dives weren't that big of a deal because we see them all the time. But this is a show, Monday Night Raw. It feels like it's just spinning its wheels every week and trying things that are not working. Well, here's something that does work. There are tons of VPN providers out there. You've probably heard of a few of them. You may have even used one before. You may also remember me promoting ExpressVPN right here on this podcast. They are once again sponsoring the show, but I have been a user of their service all year long. And I am more than happy to promote them again because they have a great service that works. ExpressVPN, they don't log your data. Lots of really cheap or free VPNs make money by selling your data to ad companies. ExpressVPN developed a technology called Trusted Server that makes it impossible for their servers to log any of your information. And then there's the speed. I've tried a few other VPNs before, mostly free ones, and a lot of them slow your connection down or they make your device very sluggish. I've had that problem remoting in through my work VPN, for example. In the time that I've been using ExpressVPN, my internet speeds have been as fast as they always are. Even when I connect to a server thousands of miles away in another country, I can still stream HD quality videos with zero lag. And what really sets ExpressVPN apart from other services, though, is how easy it is to use. You don't have to input or program anything. You just fire up the app. You click one button, literally one button, to connect. And I'm not the only one saying this. Wired, The Verge, CNET, other tech websites rate ExpressVPN the number one VPN in the world. So protect yourself with the VPN that I use, the one that I trust. Use our link, expressvpn.com/solomonster, right now and get an extra 3 months free on a one-year package. That's 90 extra days for free. Only when you use our link, expressvpn.com/solomonster, and you help out the podcast when you do. Visit expressvpn.com/solomonster to learn more. I thought SmackDown Friday night was a big step back from the week before. We had Miz and Morrison with another edition of the Dirt Sheet explaining the move of Mandy Rose to Monday Night Raw, and Miz putting a word in with some of the higher-ups at USA Network to make that happen. Otis, who obviously is not happy that his peach has been traded to another show, he went on the attack. He beat up Morrison. He beat up Miz. He stripped the Miz down to his tighty-whities. He's been clearly watching old tuxedo matches from Raw with Howard Finkel and Harvey Whippleman. Later on, we see The Miz in the back. He's on the phone clearly to his lawyer asking, hey, was that enough? Was that enough? As if he had goaded Otis into coming out and beating him up. Later on, Otis has served papers for a lawsuit alleging emotional distress, destruction of personal property, money in the bank negligence, which I didn't know was a crime, which is great. Knowing that that's a crime is fantastic. Arrest the whole fucking creative team then, if that's the case. If that's a crime, if that's a felony, arrest all of them. And also, creating an unsafe work environment, which I had to laugh at. Are you kidding me? This entire company is one giant unsafe work environment. Do you see what goes on these shows every week? So Tucker tells Otis he's got 1 week to surrender the money in the bank contract, or else they're going to take him to court. And I love how Otis said, Tucky, we got a problem, Tucky. And Tucky's like, no, Otis, you have a problem. It's like, keep me out of your shit. This ain't my problem. This is your problem. This is what happens when you get involved with another woman. You could have just stuck with me. I'm your best friend. I'm your tag team partner. You bring a woman into things, and look what happens. Everything goes to hell. You know that's what Tucker was thinking. But I watched this entire thing, and I like Otis, I do. I like Otis, but I felt dumber having watched this segment. I felt dumber for having watched what I just saw. That is, until I saw the Matt Riddle segment. We got a pre-taped promo. This was Matt Riddle's, this is the big Matt Riddle segment on the show this week. We got a pre-taped Matt Riddle promo where he told us why he uses the word bro so much. So, you know, WWE, what they like to do, when somebody gets called up to the main roster, they like to beat you over the head with things. Subtlety is not one of their specialties, right? So in NXT, Matt Riddle came out, he would say bro a lot. He doesn't wear shoes in the ring, right? He wrestles barefoot. But they didn't beat you over the head with it like, oh, here comes, this guy doesn't wear any shoes, and he says bro a lot. Comes to the main roster, now he's the barefoot, what that name they gave him a few weeks ago? I already forgot what it was. I tried to block it from my memory. The bodacious barefoot bro. Is that what they call this fucking guy? I think that's what they called him. It was like the bodacious barefoot bro. Because, you know, he doesn't wear any shoes, so we got to beat you over the head with it. But he also says bro a lot. Well, in case you didn't know that, we'll have him tell you why he says the word bro a lot. He says, well, you know, you can convey almost any emotion just by using the word bro, bro. Yeah, Vince Russo is well aware of that. I didn't need Matt Riddle to tell me this. You can be happy, and he went through all of these different emotions saying the word bro. You can say it in a happy way. You can say it in a sad way. You can say it in a mad way. You can be afraid. You could also be completely fucking brain dead like the person who came up with this hideous segment. You could do that, too. If the goal here was to make Matt Riddle, who I still believe has main event potential, maybe not right now at this moment, but yes, Matt Riddle is one of those top like five guys on the SmackDown brand that you could position at the top of the brand and build that brand around. You got Roman Reigns, you've got Daniel Bryan when he's ready to come back. The Fiend is still around. I don't know what Braun Strowman is doing. He's hanging out on Raw Underground now. But you've got Matt Riddle. I'd like to see Big E, frankly, worked up to that level at some point too. There you go. And you can build your brand around these guys. Instead, they put a segment like this out. And I know some people are going to watch this and they're going to go, well, I thought it was funny. Okay, fine. Good for you. You thought it was funny. What I'm telling you is that when you have a guy who you could be doing something more serious with, you want him to actually make you money. You want him to be a big star on the brand. All this segment did was it made him look like a fucking geek. If that was the goal here, then mission accomplished. Congratulations. But that's all I took away from this segment. If this were R-Truth doing this or something, then fine. That's his role on the show. He's very good at it. I just hate how they have to just beat you over the head with everything. Like, we're all a bunch of six-year-olds. Like, we can't just see for ourselves. Yeah, he says bro a lot, and he doesn't wear any shoes. Who the fuck cares? Morons. Alexa Bliss. Alexa Bliss joining. You could tell. You could from the G1 to this. You could see the many moods of Solomonster here on episode 670. I should do one of those segments. I can be happy. I can be sad. I can be mad. I run the whole gamut of emotions here on this one episode. By the end, I might go crazy. Alexa Bliss joined commentary for a Nikki Cross-Lacey Evans match. Lacey Evans, who was dead for a while this week, according to Wikipedia. Someone pointed it out to Lacey on Twitter, and she wondered, how did I die, though? It didn't say how she died. It just said that Lacey Evans used to be a star on the SmackDown brand before her death. It didn't actually say how she died. Thankfully, she was brought back to life. She sprayed hand sanitizer in Nikki's face late in the match, and Michael Cole was incredulous over that, not being a disqualification. He couldn't believe it. Well, he's not wrong. I will side with Michael Cole on this one. That should have been a disqualification. After Nikki won, Lacey crawled out of the ring. She crawled over and tried to use the announce desk to kind of, you know, bring herself back up. And she looked over at Alexa and she was talking smack about Alexa Bliss. And somewhere in here, she mentioned The Fiend. And as soon as she mentioned The Fiend, that is when Alexa went into another one of her trances. She got up, she walked over, and she laid out Lacey Evans with Sister Abigail on the floor. And then she walked off all the way to the back. The camera was following her, the woman in the back, I don't know her name, she's one of the new ones, but she was trying to interview Alexa. Alexa was in a trance. She wasn't answering. She was looking forward. She looks like me whenever I walk by a Popeyes and I get a whiff of some of that chicken. I'm in a trance-like state. Sasha Banks. Remember what I was just talking about? How they had to just keep Sasha Banks off TV, right? There's a big injury angle. She hurt her knee. She put a chair around the woman's throat and stomped on it. Like, that's a big injury angle there. Sasha Banks was back on TV this week. Sasha Banks was live from the Performance Center for an interview. Wearing a neck brace, thank God. She should not have been on the show at all. Mandalorian or no Mandalorian. Sasha Banks is in the second season, by the way, in case you live under a rock. The trailer dropped this week. That's all anybody was talking about. Sasha Banks, her name was trending in the world. It was trending. I think maybe number five in the world or something. And think about everything going on in the world, especially this week. And Sasha Banks' name was trending. So that was big news. Mandalorian or no Mandalorian? Baby Yoda doesn't give a shit. You do an injury angle like that, you keep that person off television for at least a few weeks before putting them back on. But at least she had a neck brace on. She ran the gamut of emotions here. This seems to be a recurring theme here on this show this week. She ran the gamut of emotions in her promo from sadness to anger over what Bayley did to her, her best friend, what she did to her. a couple of weeks earlier. She talked about being in the PC and what this place means to her and how the two of them helped build this place. They trained together. They talked about taking over the whole damn company together, which is what they accomplished this summer. She said Bailey is nothing without her. And one day she's going to take away from her the one thing that she loves the most, that being the SmackDown Women's Championship. And at that moment, Bailey showed up with a chair. She attacked Sasha. So there's a mole on the inside who obviously tipped off Bailey that Sasha was going to be over at the PC. I want to know who that mole was. Who was the person that tipped off Bailey that Sasha was going to be at the PC? I think it's Triple H. He's just trying to stir up some shit. He's just like Vince. Gotta stir up shit between your performers. So she attacks Sasha and wrapped a chair yet again. She hit her with the chair, but then she wrapped the chair around her neck. She was going to stomp on it again. And I'm sitting here watching this and I'm going, go ahead, do it, do it. Stomp on it. That means it'll keep her out longer. And they can save the match for WrestleMania. But a bunch of Performance Center dweebs came in and they saved her and removed the chair from around her neck. And Bailey just left. That was it. Bailey left. Now we get an update from WWE that Sasha was just shaken up by the attack. No further injuries were sustained. They never told us what her injuries even were in the first place. Did they mention it on SmackDown and I may have just missed it? Or I guess just wearing the neck brace implies an injury. We were never told what the injury is. Does she have a neck sprain? Does she have a broken neck? What's the injury? We were never told. What about her knee? Nothing. We were told nothing. They are totally doing this match at Hell in a Cell next month. I have resigned to it. It's going to happen. They might even headline the show with it. Who knows? But they're totally doing this match at Hell in a Cell. When does that second season of The Mandalorian actually drop? I thought I read October 30th, right? Is it the day before Halloween? And the pay-per-view, Hell in a Cell, is 5 days before? Yeah. They're doing the match on that show. In fact, she's probably winning the title on that show. AJ Styles and Sami Zayn had a good match. Zayn tried to win by rolling up AJ with a fistful of tights. The referee caught him. AJ then turned around and did the same thing. He did a better job of hiding it from the referee. I like that. You have two heels cheating. One heel was upset that the other one did a better job of cheating. Jeff Hardy ran down, or I should say rather, he limped down to the ring and took out both guys. He pulled a ladder out from under the ring and issued the challenge to both for a triple threat ladder match for the Intercontinental title at Clash of Champions. It's like I pitched here weeks ago. They need to have both belts hanging above the ring, and whoever grabs them both is the undisputed Intercontinental champion. Jeff Hardy, by the way, it appears, nothing has been officially announced, but he did an interview with BT Sport, and it sure sounds like Jeff Hardy has re-signed with WWE. He has re-signed a new contract with the company. He said part of his new deal is that when they let fans back into the buildings, and you know it's going to happen soon. It's going to happen very, very soon. There's no way that Vince McMahon is going to be told that AEW has however much capacity fans at their shows. New Japan now is running 50% capacity at their shows. It won't be long. The Thunderdome is not long for this world. And it's only a matter of time before we get fans back in the buildings. I don't know if they're waiting for a certain number to bring back Jeff's music. But he said that once they get fans back into the buildings, part of his deal, this is part of what he negotiated into his deal, is that he gets to go back to using his old No More Words theme song that he was using in the late 2000s before he left the company after the run with CM Punk. Now, he said that back in March. He was on the bump back in March and said the song was coming back. It's coming back, he said. And that was 6 months ago, and then it never came back. So I guess it doesn't take much to get Jeff Hardy to stay. Just give him his old theme song back. Now we know why they took Keith Lee's theme song away from him. It's a bargaining chip when his contract is up. They're going to use it for leverage. All these wrestlers are marks for their own theme music. In the back, Sheamus is with King Corbin. They're talking about their match in the main event. It was going to be a Samoan street fight against Roman Reigns and Jey Uso. All of a sudden, a security guard comes over. It's the same security guard that I guess, kind of laid the trap for Big E when Big E went to go. Remember somebody said that Xavier Woods is here and he went into the parking garage area and he was attacked by Sheamus. And Sheamus was happy to see the guy and the guy told him, you know, your car is being towed. And Sheamus goes and he runs out to go see what's going on. And when he gets there, there's a guy standing there with his back turned. And when the guy turns around, it's Big E. And Sheamus runs away. Why Big E did not chase after Sheamus was never... And this is one of those things on WWE television that I hate. If you have this hatred for someone and you want to get revenge on them, it's like when they leave the ring, guys will just stay in the ring and make a mean face like, I'll get you next time. It's like, no, motherfucker, leave the ring and go after the guy. Sheamus runs off and Big E does not run after him. Instead, Big E takes out all his aggression on the poor security guard. So he beats up the security guard. He gives him a belly-to-belly suplex on the car windshield. This was not a good week for car windshields. Between this and Trent being powerbombed onto one on Dynamite, not a good week for car windshields, but a great week for the dealers who have to go ahead and replace those windshields. It's a nice little payday for them. The dealers or the mechanic, the chop shop, whatever. It's a good week for them. Not so much a good week for the windshields themselves. But yeah, so Sheamus ran off, and I guess he was content to let him run away, and he took out his aggression on the poor security guard. I think this was great to see Big E kind of get serious and show real anger and real fire. When Big E, who we're so used to seeing doing goofy kind of comedy stuff, trying to make people laugh, when we see him get angry, he can be a very scary man. It's a side I'd like to see more often. Let's have a nice balance between happy-go-lucky Big E and when there's a reason for him to get angry, angry Big E, who shows a lot of fire and just tosses guys around. So that I liked. Then we had the Samoan street fight. Roman Reigns and Jey Uso against Sheamus and King Corbin. They wrestled this like a straight babyface versus heel tag team match. You know, Reigns beat down Corbin with a chair in the ring. He went to go pull out a table. Sheamus cut him off. The heels tossed Roman over the announce desk at one point. There was a spot where the heels put Jey Uso, double powerbomb, in the ring through a table. That should have been the finish. And Jey Uso kicked out. That should never be a near fall. I'm sorry. That should have been the finish. But the heels weren't going over, so of course that wasn't the finish. Then Roman should have been there to save him then, because I don't know. I was irrationally upset that he kicked out of that. Sheamus tried to give Reigns white noise on the announce desk. Reigns used a low blow, gave him a Samoan drop on the desk, which did not break. Reigns then speared Sheamus through the barricade into all the virtual fans. There was a little bit of a delay, so like, he spears them, and there's no reaction from the fans. But then a few seconds later, they're like, oh, they have the shocked look on their face. So that looked a little goofy. Uso hit Corbin with the Universal Championship, and Roman Reigns speared Baron Corbin. Uso immediately comes down with a Samoan splash for the pin. After the match, Jey Uso was so hyped up, man. He was so amped up, so happy. He was celebrating in the ring, and Roman Reigns didn't know what to make of this, and he gave his cousin a big hug, and Roman had this big smile on his face. And they were hugging for a very, 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 very long time. So that we got this shot from all different angles. There were probably 30 camera cuts in this segment alone. But they're shooting this long, extended hug, and again, Roman is smiling. He seems to be happy, right? Even though you know he's not. And when the hug finally comes to a close and Jey Uso goes and walks off, they keep the camera on Roman Reigns and Paul Heyman is standing right behind him and Roman is still smiling and he's still smiling and then very slowly his facial expression begins to change. And what did I talk about? How many times have I talked about it just in this SmackDown review alone in terms of the different emotions, right? I talked about it with Matt Riddle. I talked about it with Sasha Banks. I talked about it with myself. Now we're going to talk about it with Roman Reigns because Roman Reigns went from happy to angry and pissed off in record time. And he did a tremendous job of it. The way that his smile just faded away from his face into just a furious scowl was fantastic. I thought Roman Reigns' facial expressions at the end here conveying that emotion was absolutely outstanding. Jey Uso is going to die at the hands of his cousin next week, and it will be glorious. And for the people who are still on the fence about what is Roman a heel, or maybe they're still cheering for him, hopefully this will cement in their minds whether or not Roman Reigns is a babyface or a heel, which is, again, why they're doing this. It's got to be the reason why they're doing this. And Jey Uso is going to be the victim next Sunday. So the ending I thought was great, but I thought this was a much weaker show than we've seen, because there have been some good SmackDowns, but man, I mean, this show, boy, you know, it's so Heckle and Jekyll, or Heckle, I don't know what the fuck I'm saying. I'm Jekyll. The fuck am I, where am I getting Heckle from? Jekyll and Hyde. This show has been so Jekyll and Hyde, it's, I don't know. One week it's good, then the next 2 weeks it's shit, and then they'll bust out a home run, and then the next 3 weeks will be garbage. Very inconsistent. So let's talk a little bit now about AEW and NXT. Back in their normal spots on Wednesday, this week, the audiences for Dynamite and NXT were both down. I knew AEW was not pulling in a million viewers. I figured they would be back into the 900,000 range. And I knew that NXT would be down as well, although I didn't know it would be down by as much as it was down. And you would think, looking at these numbers, it's a no-brainer that USA Network would want to move NXT to a Tuesday night or a Thursday night just to get away from Wednesdays. NXT charted number 31 in the demo this week. 689,000 viewers overall. AEW was down from over a million last week to 886,000, which is still a strong number, but yeah, when you compare it to over a million, that's a big drop. But that is exactly the reason why NXT is not going anywhere. If Vince McMahon has anything to say about it, NXT ain't going nowhere. That right there is the reason why. They can prevent AEW from expanding the audience and getting over a million viewers every week. And that's why it's not going to happen. AEW was number 3. NXT was 31. AEW was number 3 on the 18 to 49 demo chart this week, which I'm sure makes TNT very happy. It's a lot better than number 31. But this was one of the best episodes of Dynamite in a very long time. They had an outstanding parking lot main event, parking lot fight with the Best Friends against Santana and Ortiz. I saw that Meltzer in the Observer this week gave it 5 stars. I cannot disagree. And yeah, I don't put all the faith in the Meltzer star system. Some people make such a big deal about it. At the end of the day, it's the guy's opinion. People lose their minds over it. It always makes me laugh. But I saw that and I thought to myself, would I do the same? And I was thinking about it. And you know what? I can't disagree with that rating. It was one of the best brawls of any kind that I've ever seen. On the live stream Wednesday night, right after, I compared it to the Cactus Jack and Max Payne versus Nasty Boys street fight from the Spring Stampede pay-per-view that WCW did in 1994. That was a lot of fun to watch, but my God, was that a brutal fucking match. Those guys, and especially Foley, but all those guys, took a hell of a lot of abuse in that match. This reminded me a lot of that one, right down to having Tony Schiavone on commentary, just like he was in 94. Right down to having Schiavone on commentary calling the match. And that closing scene with Trent's mom, we had Sue back on TV. That closing scene with Trent's mom driving them off, or starting to drive away in the SUV and then stopping and reaching out the window and putting the middle finger up and flipping off Santana and Ortiz. That was the best finish to an episode of Dynamite that I have ever seen. Since the show premiered on TV last year, that was the best closing shot, the best close of any kind to an episode of Dynamite ever. And the most satisfying. That is how you pay off a feud, right there. There's no reason to run this back again, do a rematch. Like, that was the perfect close to that chapter, and now both teams can move on. I would like to see Santana and Ortiz actually start racking up more wins. but they can do it against other teams. This feud, as far as I'm concerned, the book is closed, the chapter has been written, and now they can move on to other things. Now, there have been reports of heat between Thunder Rosa and Ivelisse stemming from their NWA Women's Championship match on Wednesday night. I saw reports of them. Oh, they were shooting on each other during the match on Wednesday. It looked to me like they were working stiff, but just because two people work a little stiff with each other does not mean that they're shooting. Everyone was jumping right away. Oh, they were shooting. They were shooting. I don't know that they were shooting. They were working stiff for sure. But you would think that if there was some kind of a problem, if there was a major issue here, I don't think they would be putting them back in the ring together this week. It's going to be Ivelisse and Diamante against Hikaru Shida and Thunder Rosa. But I did see the Snapmare spot. I'm sure a lot of you also saw the same one. It was gift and put on Twitter. It was floating around all over the place. I didn't talk about it on Wednesday night because I didn't see it. So either I stepped away or I was probably taking notes on something I had just seen and I looked down for 10 seconds and I didn't see this. I only saw it when people started circulating it on social media. It was the Snapmare spot out of the corner. Thunder Rosa gave Ivelisse a Snapmare into a full Nelson on the mat. And Ivelisse completely no-sold the whole sequence. She no-sold the Snapmare, and the Snapmare is not a devastating move. But she's sitting there, she could not possibly look any less interested. She no-sold that, she no-sold the full Nelson. She's literally just sitting there like, all right, let's go to the next spot, go ahead, cinch it in. And if I had seen that on the first airing, believe me, I would have talked about that on Wednesday. That was completely unprofessional. And I have been a big advocate for AEW giving Ivelisse a look and giving her a chance because I thought she could be an asset to that women's division. And I still feel that way. I still feel she can be an asset to that AEW women's division. But there is no excuse for pulling a stunt like that in the ring. I don't have a problem with them laying in their shots. To me, that's fine. But she didn't just no-sell the move. She looked completely disinterested in what was going on. How does she not understand that this could be her last chance? I mean, does she not recognize this? This could be this woman's last shot on a national stage, and she is going to fuck it all up. And then she'll have no one to blame but herself. She will not be able to blame AEW or WWE or anyone else. She will have nobody to blame but Ivelisse. Now keep in mind that she and Diamante won the women's tag team tournament. They won the tournament. We have yet to hear that either one of them have been signed. Tay Conti got signed. We heard that. We got that announcement. Where is the announcement that Ivelisse has been signed? Unless they offered her something and she turned it down, which I can't imagine, but it's possible. If that didn't happen, then obviously she has yet to be offered anything. That tells you something right there. I'm assuming she's probably working on a per-appearance deal at this point with the company. And I know she's had a rough month. She went on Twitter and she talked about how she lost her home recently due to a fire. That's rough, you know, that's terrible. But if she screws this up, she's done. She doesn't make the most of this opportunity. That's it. She will have squandered what will probably be her last chance on a big stage like this. And there will not be anyone to blame for that but Ivelisse. They're teasing another match between Shida and Rosa, this time for the NWA women's title. Shida came to her aid after the match. She placed the NWA women's title over Rosa's shoulder and then walked away. I figured it happens on the anniversary episode of Dynamite that they're plugging for October 14. But somebody in the chat during the live stream on Wednesday said that, hey, maybe the idea is to do the match on an NWA show, right? Because they had Rosa on the All Out pay-per-view. One good turn deserves another. And so now if they do an NWA women's title match, they would do it on an NWA show. The NWA is partnered now on a new weekly pay-per-view series on Thursday nights called Primetime Live, and it's streaming. It might be on traditional pay-per-view, but I know it's also streaming on Fight TV. You have to pay for it, but it is streaming weekly now on Fight TV. In fact, Nick Aldis had just, this past Thursday, he defended his NWA World's Heavyweight Championship against Mike Bennett, successfully defended it against him. The show, it was a mix of matches from different indie promotions. It is not just an NWA show. NWA is part of it. Dave Marquez, I think, is promoting it. Dave Marquez was an announcer on NWA Power. So there's your tie-in right there. Some of the people who ordered the show claim they had some streaming issues, but they seem to enjoy it. And look, I suppose they could do the match on one of those primetime live pay-per-views. You know, if Billy Corgan is allowing Thunder Rosa to appear for AEW, then Tony Khan would probably let Sheeta wrestle a match on an NWA show or a show that the NWA is partnered on, especially if Rosa, if the idea is that Rosa would get her win back. I could see them wanting it to be on an NWA show and not having their champion, the AEW Women's Champion, being pinned and losing on an AEW show. Rosa defends her NWA Women's title, by the way, on the primetime pay-per-view this Thursday against Priscilla Kelly. So that is her next title defense that is coming up. Tuesday is a special late-night Dynamite after the NBA playoffs. That is the one-hour taped show that would have aired on Wednesday this past week if Dynamite had been bumped to Thursday, which it was not. There is going to be a match between Anna Jay and Brandi Rhodes. And the main event is Matt Sydal against Sean Spears. And on the live two-hour Dynamite this Wednesday, Moxley, Darby Allin, and Will Hobbs, who has been signed by AEW. I guess he's kind of like a new project for them. Has a lot of potential. They're certainly vaulting him into a prime position there. He's teaming with Darby Allin and the world champion. They're going to be taking on Lance Archer, Brian Cage, and Ricky Starks. Orange Cassidy is getting a TNT title shot against Mr. Brody Lee. And Hikaru Shida, as I mentioned, teams with Thunder Rosa to take on Ivelisse and Diamante. And there's going to be a lot of eyeballs on that match, especially when Rosa and Ivelisse are in the ring together. But like I said, she's got to be smart enough to recognize that if there are issues of any kind, if she's not getting along with people, if there's any kind of tumultuous exchanges or anything going on here, I've not heard any stories about this sort of thing with anyone else that AEW has brought in. You know, Ivelisse had a reputation that, rightly or wrongly, followed her around. And now she's getting an opportunity with AEW, and these stories are popping up again. That's not good. She needs to recognize that before it's too late. So we'll see. It's going to be a lot of very interested people, I think, watching that match on Wednesday. Now let's switch over to NXT here just for a few quick minutes. We had a match that I wanted to go out of the way here to mention, the opener between Io Shirai and Shotzi Blackheart. It was not for the championship, but this was a killer opener on NXT this week. It was the best Shotzi Blackheart match that I've ever seen, and I have not followed the entirety of her career. I saw some of her Evolve work, but best Shotzi match easily that I have ever seen. This was really, really good. Shotzi caught Io at one point with a dragon suplex. You know, arms hooked behind her. Io kicked out. Blackheart transitioned into a cattle mutilation. Just one time. One time. I would love to hear a WWE announcer be allowed to acknowledge that move by that name on TV. It would amuse me. It would amuse me to hear, you know, who's the new guy that they brought in to replace Tom? Vic Joseph. He's not new, but I would love to hear Vic Joseph just lose his mind, shouting, cattle mutilation, cattle mutilation. You'd have people who have no idea that move is called that who would be, what the fuck is he saying? It would amuse me. It would amuse me to see the comments on social media. Missile dropkick by Io for a near fall. Blackheart fights back, gives her a super Frankensteiner off the ropes for a near fall. And Shotzi went to counter a superplex. Io countered to give Shotzi a very scary German suplex on the apron. Io running knee strikes in the corner. And the genius of the sky, moonsault for the win. They shook hands after. They hugged. They embraced like good sports. That was an excellent match. And this Wednesday, they're holding a battle royal to determine the next challenger to Io's title at the next TakeOver show. Rhea Ripley has to be the favorite. Tegan Nox is in there, Candice LeRae is in there, but, you know, one of them is going to eliminate the other, or they're both going to eliminate each other, so they're basically going to cancel each other out. They're clearly building to a match with those two, so they're not going to win. Yeah, I mean, Rhea is the favorite. Rhea would not be an unpredictable pick, but she would probably be the right one. Jake Atlas, he returned to challenge Tommaso Ciampa to a match next week after Ciampa put him out of action for a few weeks. Late in the show, Atlas was leaving. He was being interviewed. He got jumped from behind by Ciampa. Ciampa was beating him up. Kyle O'Reilly ran over. There were two random security guys, but then Kyle O'Reilly comes over and he chases, not chases, but he basically tries to get Tommaso Ciampa to back off. I have no idea what's going on with the Undisputed Era. You've got Adam Cole, who seems to be a babyface now. Roddy and Bobby Fish, they're clearly still positioned as heels. And now Kyle O'Reilly is off on his own, saving Jake Atlas from an attack by Tommaso Ciampa. It's all over the place right now. This whole Undisputed Era stuff is just all over the place. Maybe it's like a slow breakup, you know, like a slow-moving glacier. Going to just very slowly separate them out. We had Breezango retaining their NXT tag team titles over Imperium. I thought this was a very good match. This was a theme for NXT this week. Not a very exciting show, but I thought the opener was excellent. I thought this was very good, and I thought the main event was very good. So there was some really good in-ring action on the show this week. And I really liked the last few minutes, especially, of this match. Fandango missed a top rope leg drop. Marcel Bartel hit him with a super kick into a gut-wrench German by Fabian Aichner for a two count. There was a hot tag to Tyler Breeze. He ran wild for a bit. Imperium went up for the European bomb. They had gotten Breeze up in the air for it. That got broken up, and Tyler Breeze countered into a Rana on Aichner, and then he hooked his legs forward to score the pin. And, you know, with NXT UK now finally back to producing new shows, I guess this probably sends Imperium back overseas to link up again with Walter. Yeah, I haven't forgotten about that match they were promoting with Walter and Finn Balor. We never got the match. It was supposed to be at the Dublin Takeover show back in April. And then they delayed the Dublin Takeover show to October. I believe the date they delayed it to was October 25th. Now that Hell in a Cell got bumped up a week, and Hell in a Cell is airing on the network the same night, I assume that means that show is not happening now, at least not on that day. But I have not forgotten about this match that we never got. Maybe when Balor drops the NXT Championship, if travel restrictions allow for it, if he's in no great rush to go back to Raw or SmackDown, maybe he can get that NXT UK run. And we can get the match between Balor and Walter. I want to see that match at some point. We had a match with Drake Maverick. It was supposed to be Drake Maverick and Killian Dane, who he has been courting as his new tag team partner now for weeks, and Dane wants nothing to do with this guy. They were taking on Roderick Strong and Bobby Fish of Undisputed Era. So Maverick started the match, no Killian Dane. This guy is being beaten down 2-on-1 multiple times. The camera cut to show Killian Dane sitting in the back, watching on a monitor, rather enjoying himself. And I was looking at this and I thought to myself, holy shit, he was sitting down. He was sitting down looking up at the TV like a normal person. Someone's getting fired for that. Don't they know he's supposed to be standing beside the TV, watching it at an awkward angle? Don't they teach these people anything down there? What are they doing at the PC these days? William Regal ended up confronting Killian Dane and basically guilted him into going out to help his tag team partner, which really was just to throw Maverick back into the ring. And his great words of encouragement were, take it like a man. And he went to go leave, but he overheard Bobby Fish and Kyle O'Reilly talking smack about him behind his back. And so he ran down to beat them both up. Bobby Fish hit Dane with a chair for the DQ. Maverick took the chair away from Fish. Fish walked right into a pump kick from Killian Dane. And the UE bailed. Maverick gave Dane a friendly shove. Because he was all fired up. So he gave him a friendly shove out of excitement. And he screamed at him that we're a tag team now. We're a tag team. Killian Dane then knocked him out with one punch. And he walked out. Your future NXT tag team champions, folks. Right here. Killian Dane and Drake Maverick. William Regal announced a new concept. New concept for next week called the Gauntlet Eliminator Match. To determine a new number one contender for Finn Balor's NXT Championship. The rules are as follows. Two wrestlers will begin. Every 4 minutes thereafter, another wrestler will enter the fray. Eliminations are pinfall or submission only. And the last man standing goes on to face Balor for the championship at TakeOver on October 4th. That's 2 days before my birthday. So basically what it is, it's the Aztec Warfare match from Lucha Underground, only without the over-the-top rope eliminations also being allowed. Or, you know what, it's also like that Battle Riot match that MLW does. So far, we know that Kushida is in. Cameron Grimes, he's in there as well. There's Cameron Grimes. I was wondering where he's been. So Cameron Grimes is in there. And Kyle O'Reilly is in the Gauntlet Eliminator. So it looks like we are finally going to get a Kyle O'Reilly singles push, which sounds good to me. It also makes sense now that Ciampa told him that he would be seeing him soon. When Kyle got into his business earlier and chased him away from Jake Atlas, those were the parting words from Tommaso Ciampa, the very haunting parting words from Tommaso Ciampa. We'll be seeing each other soon. And so that tells me that Ciampa may be interfering and costing O'Reilly the match. Ciampa probably won't be in the gauntlet himself because they've already announced the match for this week between he and Jake Atlas. And if the Velveteen Dream is not entered into the Gauntlet Eliminator, I could see him costing Kushida because Kushida attacked him a few weeks ago and we haven't seen the Dream since. So I can't really pick a winner without knowing all of the participants. Dexter Lumis, I don't know what his injury status is, if he'll maybe be back. Maybe he'll be in the Gauntlet Eliminator. I tell you what, though. I picked him to win the North American title ladder match, and it didn't pan out. But I'm going to bring him up again here. Cameron Grimes. I would not count out Cameron Grimes. Finn Balor has had issues with him in the past. If they want somebody who can give Balor a great takeover match, but is obviously going to lose, Cameron Grimes, I think, would be your perfect bet. I think he'd be your man. So he'd be my early pick for the Eliminator this week, but I can't really give you a firm answer because I just don't know everybody who's going to be in it yet. And Damian Priest, in his very first defense of the NXT North American Championship, successfully defended the title. Good main event here. Against Timothy Thatcher. Priest blocked the half crab a couple of times. Thatcher finally got it locked in. Priest got out of it. Locked on the Fujiwara armbar. Did Thatcher. Priest escaped and hit Thatcher with a sit-out choke slam for a two count. Priest got to the top rope. Hit Thatcher with a spinning heel kick. And he hit Thatcher with the Reckoning to pick up the win. So, solid win for Damian Priest as they begin to build him up as the North American champion, his first successful title defense. And an end to what I thought overall was, I mean, in ring wise, this is a very good episode of NXT. There's just no real excitement though watching the show. That feeling of excitement is missing. I think the atmosphere is part of it. But it was very wrestling wise, some very good wrestling on the show this week.
History has been made here!
This week in wrestling history, this was a busy week, 39 years ago this past week, on September 17, 1981, Ric Flair won his very first of either 16 or 23, depending on who you ask, world championships, beating Dusty Rhodes for the NWA World's Heavyweight title in Kansas City. Speaking of the Nature Boy, 22 years ago, on September 14, 1998, on a live episode of Monday Nitro from Greenville, South Carolina. They were in the Carolinas. That's Flair country. That's Horseman country. There was a Horseman reunion segment, and Nature Boy Ric Flair made his grand return to WCW television. Now, to give some context here, earlier in the year, Flair went to Eric Bischoff, and he had requested some time off from a Thunder taping to attend his son Reed's wrestling tournament, because his son Reed was an amateur wrestler. Bischoff refused. He said, no, you have to come to work. So Flair no-showed the taping anyway, and he went to his son's wrestling tournament, and so Bischoff suspended him. There was a lot of animosity between Eric Bischoff and Ric Flair at that time, and it blew over when they were in WWE, too, because Flair went after him. There was a whole incident in the back. They've since made up. I think they're friendly now with each other. But this was a very real situation, and Flair was off television for a very long time. And this ended up being one of the most memorable moments in Nitro history when Flair made his entrance here in South Carolina. You had all the horsemen in the ring. Everyone's all dressed up. Flair's dressed up. He's very emotional. He's always emotional. He's either crying or bleeding or both. And he did both things here in this segment. And he cut a hell of a promo. Bischoff came out. He was trying to kind of end the segment and cut them off. And they were playing this like a work shoot. Flair's talking about Bischoff. And, you know, fire me. I'm already fired. It was one of the all-time great segments, honestly, in the history of Monday Nitro. A lot of real emotions during that segment. 21 years ago this week, in a match taped for SmackDown on September 14th, 1999, although it didn't air until September 16th, 54-year-old Vince McMahon became what I believe still to this day is the oldest WWF champion of all time when he beat Triple H in a no DQ match off of an assist from Stone Cold Steve Austin, who stunnered Triple H and placed Vince McMahon on top of him for the win. A few days later on Raw is War, McMahon vacated the championship, and it wound up going right back around Triple H's waist anyway at the Unforgiven pay-per-view in that six-pack challenge match. We live in a world where Vince McMahon exists as both the former WWE champion Vince McMahon and the former ECW champion Vince McMahon. That is probably the only thing that Vince McMahon and Rob Van Dam have in common, that they have been both WWE and ECW champion. And by the way, the ECW title, it was the WWE version, because Rob was never the ECW champion, he was the TV champion. But ECW died before he could win it the first time, so both of those runs came under the auspices of WWE. 17 years ago this week, on September 16, 2003, at a SmackDown taping in Raleigh, North Carolina, Brock Lesnar defeated Kurt Angle 5-4 in a 60-minute Iron Man match, the first ever 60-minute Iron Man match on TV, not pay-per-view. Angle had Brock in the ankle lock when the time expired. Lesnar did not tap out. I remember this, it was an excellent match. You had the issue, though, of having commercials. It was not live. It was a taped show. I'm almost positive spoilers leaked out. So it was very different in that respect from past Iron Man matches, but it was an excellent match. 14 years ago this week, on September 16, 2006, Ring of Honor made its debut at the Manhattan Center in New York City with its Glory by Honor 5 Night 2 show. This was the second Ring of Honor show that I ever attended live. My first one was maybe 3 months earlier, I think it was, in June of that year. The last show that they ever ran, right around the corner in the ballroom at the New Yorker Hotel. That was the first show I ever went to. And then all you had to do was literally you round the corner, and that's where the line started to get into the Manhattan Center, which is where WWE used to tape Monday Night Raw in the early years, right there in the Manhattan Center. Not in the Hammerstein Ballroom, which is on the first level when you walk in, but on the eighth floor. That's where Monday Night Raw used to be taped. That's where Ring of Honor ran at first until they started running Hammerstein many years later. But this was the grand ballroom, and only a couple of blocks away, they were literally in the shadow of Madison Square Garden. You were standing there on 34th Street waiting in line. You look over your shoulder and there's MSG right behind you. That's how close you were to Madison Square Garden. The same Madison Square Garden that Bruno Sammartino sold out dozens of times as the WWF champion. And Bruno was the guest of honor that night at the Ring of Honor show. The wrestlers and the fans, they gave him a hero's welcome when he came out into the ring. They surrounded the ring. Bruno went into the ring for a promo. And he was great because Bruno was still sharp as a tack. And he was great. He was great that night. He was honored to be there. The co-main events that night saw Naomi, I just changed the man's gender. Naomichi Marufuji, definitely not Naomi, in his first GHC heavyweight title defense on American soil, that being the first defense of that title on American soil, retaining it over Nigel McGuinness. That was one of the big main events. The other one, the main event, Bryan Danielson beat Kenta to retain the ROH World Championship. That Glory by Honor show is still to this day one of the very best wrestling shows that I have ever seen live. Everything was great. Everything clicked. The Bruno thing was kind of the cherry on top to get to see him in person like that. And I was sitting in the third row that night, or standing, I should say, when he came out. And it was just so great. I don't have, and it's you talk about a different era. I took pictures. I have pictures from that show, but they were all pictures I took on one of those disposable cameras. So the quality isn't great. But you were allowed to bring it. Actually, I don't know if you were allowed to. You might not have been allowed to, but I brought them in anyway. I would buy the disposable cameras, take the pictures, and that's just how it was back in the old days of 2006. And only a couple of years later, I think, I got my first BlackBerry, and I was taking pictures on there instead. It's amazing how quickly technology moves along. 9 years ago this week, on September 18, 2011, at the WWE Night of Champions pay-per-view, Mark Henry put the cherry on top of his Hall of Pain run, pitting Randy Orton with the World's Strongest Slam, the second one I believe he gave Orton in that match, to win his first World Heavyweight Championship, clean in the middle of the ring. That was his first of two straight pay-per-view wins over Randy Orton. This is a man who was signed by WWE in 1996. And so many times they would start, they would try to give him the big push. You know, he had the sexual chocolate run during the Attitude Era. But then they tried to get serious and they wanted to build him up as a monster. And he was always getting hurt. He was constantly getting hurt. He was completely injury prone. And it just never seemed like it was going to work out with Mark Henry. He had won the European title and it looked like that was about as good as it was going to get for him. But they kept giving him chances, and you know, he was working off of a big contract. And eventually everything just clicked. Very late in the game. Think about that. Signed in 1996. It really was not until 2011 that everything fell into place for Mark Henry. And by then, he was a lot closer to the end of his career than he was the beginning of it. But that Hall of Pain run was great. He just stopped giving a shit, and he would come out and he would talk smack like he owned the place and there was nobody in the world better than him. And he believed it. And it came through on TV. His promo work was just masterful. He came off like a real badass. You know, some people say that's one of the things missing in wrestling these days. You have a lot of guys who physically are on the smaller side. Or maybe they're not great on promos or things are played up too much for humor. And it can be hard for somebody who maybe is a casual fan, or if they're a new fan of wrestling, if you're an older school fan who remembers the days of all the big guys and the brawlers, it could be hard for people to watch wrestling these days and buy into the fact that these guys are real tough guys. You didn't have that problem with Mark Henry during that Hall of Pain run. You know, he'd rip your head off and shit down your neck. And you can believe it. You could buy into it. And that legitimacy is part of that, and the fact that he legitimately was one of the strongest men in the world really played into a run that did not last nearly long enough. He got hurt again. It cut his title run short. But that was a big night. And you know, one of the things I was kind of hoping and thinking maybe they would be building towards was a championship match between him and Daniel Bryan. The ultimate underdog, Daniel Bryan. I think you could have built that thing up. You could have kept the title on Mark Henry if he would have just stayed healthy all the way through WrestleMania 28 in Miami. And you could have built to a championship match at WrestleMania with Mark Henry and Daniel Bryan. And Daniel Bryan, the underdog going into it, somehow pulls it off. He slays the giant. He wins the championship, his first world heavyweight title at WrestleMania. I think you could have done that. I don't know if that was in the cards or not. He got hurt. Daniel Bryan turned heel. He had the Money in the Bank briefcase. He went heel. And they just ended up going in a totally different direction. Now, things ended up working out just fine for Daniel Bryan. But that's why I had been hoping that we were going to get that match at some point. Because I think Bryan... Now, Mark Henry was not known for having... He was not known for having excellent matches, per se. I think him working that classic David versus Goliath match with Bryan in one of the feature matches at WrestleMania, not the main event, but one of the matches at WrestleMania. I think that could have worked. I absolutely think that could have worked. 5 years ago this past week on September 14, 2015, Nikki Bella made history, and in so doing, she pissed off a lot of fans by retaining her WWE Divas Championship in a match on Raw against Charlotte Flair. Oh, we've come... Would it be full circle to say that we've come full circle? Because now, as angry as people get when Charlotte Flair is on TV and Charlotte Flair wins a match, Charlotte Flair lost this match, and people were very upset. Because Nikki Bella... Actually, I'm sorry, Charlotte Flair technically won the match. I take that back. But she was trying to win the championship, and you can't win the championship on a disqualification. And because the title cannot change hands on a DQ, it allowed Nikki Bella to retain and surpass AJ Lee's 295-day reign to become the longest reigning Divas champion of all time. They just wanted her to beat the record because less than a week later, she dropped the title to Charlotte anyway. They just wanted to beat that AJ Lee record. I believe that. They were so close, it's like, let's just do it. You know, let's just get it over with now. And, you know, as a heel, they played it up, the big celebration, and it worked out fine. You know, if you want to get heat on the woman, and she got plenty of that. There were a lot of very upset people. Now, that same night, 5 years ago on Raw, Sting wrestled for the first and last time on Monday Night Raw, first against The Big Show in a singles match. I wasn't sure if I was watching Raw or Nitro. That ended by DQ, which then led to a tag team match at the end of the night with Sting and John Cena beating Big Show and Seth Rollins. That Sunday was the Night of Champions pay-per-view on September 20th. So 5 years ago today, as I am recording this, to the very day, that saw Charlotte that night beat Nikki Bella for the Divas title. John Cena beat Seth Rollins to regain the United States Championship. Sting also wrestled his final match, challenging Seth Rollins for the WWE title in a match that saw him take not one, which was stupid enough, but two buckle bombs in the corner. That's two buckle bombs more than he should have been taking at 56 years of age, which is what Sting was in that match. Up to that point, though, Sting looked pretty good. He even did a high cross at one point off the top of the post down onto Seth Rollins on the floor. So he was moving around in there. He was not moving around like he was 56 years old. I thought he looked pretty good up until the injury. And I remember watching that night, and I didn't know how bad he was injured. Nobody really, I think, knew how badly he was hurt. But what really tipped me off is you could see he couldn't get his weight under his legs and he sort of collapsed. And I wasn't sure if he was just selling. Once we had a little pause in the match and he's like, I'm good. I got my legs back under me. I want to get back into it. I think Rollins went to shoot him off into the ropes and he collapsed like in a heap. And I remember seeing that and thinking, uh-oh. This is really bad. Something is very wrong here. And I think there were also moments where you could see he had the gloves on, but like he was trying to get feeling back in his fingers, and that's never a good sign. I give Sting a lot of credit because he finished the match. And if this were WWE today, I think they would have just called it off. But they went right to the finish, and he had put Seth in the Scorpion Deathlock. People were going nuts for that. And he got out of it. He put him in it again. That's when Seth pulled him down into the cradle and he pinned him. So he saw that match through to the end. He was not going to let that match end that way. And I give him a lot of credit for that. I think it's a very sad way for a career like his to come to an end. You can look at it a couple of different ways. You can look at it and say, look, the guy went out wrestling for the WWE Championship in the main event on pay-per-view. And that is not the worst way for him to go out. Instead of a random TV match or a match at a house show, not a house show, like an independent show somewhere in front of 50 people. There are a lot of worse ways to go out. This was not the worst, but I could also look at it and understand where Sting is coming from when he probably in his mind thinks that's not how I wanted my career to end. I wanted to end it on my terms. I didn't want to end it because of an injury. And it sucks that his career had to come to an end like that. He has said that he doesn't blame Seth for it. It's just one of those things. This was during a period where Rollins was sort of building up a little bit of a rep for being in the ring with people who ended up getting hurt. John Cena, remember his face exploded off of a knee lift from Seth Rollins. I thought there was one other match that Rollins had where somebody got hurt. It was just one bad thing after another, it felt like. But this one was... The only thing I will say is this, in terms of assigning blame, and this blame I think can be placed equally amongst Rollins and Sting. I just cannot understand why they thought that it would be wise to do a move like the buckle bomb to a guy who is 56 years old. And to this day, it's been 5 years, I will die on that hill. I will never understand why they thought it would be good. You know, Sting is in there. He can pretty much do most everything that he ever did before. That to me, though, was a move where even if you know how to take the move, there's enough risk involved where why would you even chance it? And to do it twice, you already did it once and Sting was kind of feeling his fingers, but he was able to continue on. If they would have just continued the match and didn't go to the move again, it would have been fine. So that to me is something I've never been able to understand. Why they thought it would be a good move. Why Rollins wouldn't think, you know what, in this match, let's not do that, let's try this. Or when he pitched it, why Sting was like, yeah, let's do it. Because I'm sure he was just trying to fit in and look, I don't want you to treat me any differently than you would treat any other opponent, but that was just a really stupid thing to do. And so that, to me, is one of the more frustrating parts about how that whole thing worked out. And finally here... 3 years ago this week, on September 17, 2017, the same day that he and Gorilla Monsoon were named the permanent announce team for Wrestling Challenge back in 1986, the greatest manager, wrestling manager of all time, and one of the greatest performers really of any kind in the professional wrestling business, Bobby the Brain Heenan, passed away 2 months shy of his 73rd birthday. Bobby, you know, he came out with a book. Actually, I think he had a couple of books. And I never knew, for example, that he never graduated high school. He dropped out in the eighth grade so that he could begin working to support his family. So his story is kind of interesting in that respect. But I think of Bobby and I just think, you know, all the men that he managed in the Heenan family, it's a who's who of big names in pro wrestling. Going back to his days in the AWA, the Heenan family was not a WWF creation. The Heenan family goes all the way back to the AWA days. At least. He was managing the AWA champion, Nick Bockwinkle. I remember him, yeah, I think of him walking Andre the Giant to the ring at WrestleMania 3 at the Silver Dome. And all the guys he managed from King Kong Bundy to Big John Studd, Paul Orndorff, Harley Race, Ravishing Rick Rude, Mr. Perfect, the Brainbusters, Hercules, Haku, the Barbarian, Ric Flair. Now that wasn't a long run. That was right around the time that Bobby made the decision that he wasn't going to manage anymore. You know, he had the bum neck and he was going to go full time into commentary. But they linked him up with Ric Flair when Flair initially came into the WWF. And so you look at the number of performers and wrestlers that he worked with and he managed across multiple promotions. And like I said before, it's a who's who of big names in the wrestling business. You know, the 1992 Royal Rumble, I love to talk about that on the show. Anybody who listens to my podcast is probably sick of me talking about it, but I talk about it because it is the greatest Rumble match that company ever booked. And you had a ton of big names in it, and commentary played a very big role. The commentary of Bobby Heenan that night, along with Monsoon, it is the best night of commentary that I have ever heard, ever, on a WWF show. And Bobby freaking out, you knew the relationship between him and Flair, every little thing, and then Monsoon trying to talk him off the ledge and just put him in his place when he was talking out of line. It was great. It was great. It was fantastic. And something that Bobby mentioned in his autobiography is that he claims that it was his idea. He was the one who made the initial suggestion about Ric Flair entering the Royal Rumble early and going all the way to the end to win. It was his suggestion that Flair enter at number one. And he claims that Vince McMahon tweaked it. He just had to put his own little stamp on it. And so he made Flair come in number three instead of number one, and then claimed that it was his idea. So that's what Bobby claims anyway in his book. I hadn't known that. But two men who can claim to be the last two members of the Heenan family if they really wanted to. The last two men that Bobby ever managed. A lot of people actually probably don't know this. CM Punk and Colt Cabana. They are technically the last two members of the Heenan family. It was a very short stint that Bobby had with Ring of Honor. He came in there for a little bit. But he did indeed manage Punk and Cabana at least once. I don't know if there's video footage of it or not. But how cool must that have been for those two guys? To have Bobby Heenan walking you to the ring and being your manager? He went into the Hall of Fame in 2004. Still one of the greatest Hall of Fame speeches ever given. And his speech was already suffering at that point because of the treatment for the cancer. But I mean, you could tell he was having so much fun up there on that dais. And the parting line about his only regret, the very end of his speech, he puts that line in there about, "I only wish that Monsoon were here." I can't watch that without, I just can't. I can't watch that without losing my shit. The hell that throat cancer put this guy through, even after he went into remission, because I think it was 2002 when he was initially diagnosed. I don't know if the cancer ever came back. I don't know that he ever had a recurrence of the throat cancer. He might have, but I think it was just more a case of the treatment that he underwent to put it into remission was so intense. It caused him so much suffering and so many problems and follow-up surgeries, and it really disintegrated his jaw, is what it did. Because that's where they were doing the treatment, maybe radiation and stuff. And, I mean, the stuff that this guy went through, you can say this about a lot of cancer patients, I wouldn't wish that on anybody. It's the sort of thing no human being should have to endure, no child, nobody should have to go through that. He had reconstructive surgery years later on his jaw. I mean, it was just one health issue after another. You know, there were constant stories about him falling. You know, every few months I'd read in the Observer that Bobby Heenan, you know, we got a note that Bobby Heenan suffered another fall. He broke his shoulder. This time he fell, he broke his hip. He broke his hip twice, I think, on two separate falls over the years. And I always found the most cruel part about Bobby getting sick, and getting sick specifically with what he got sick from, is that it was throat cancer. Of all things, think about how Bobby made his money. Think about how Bobby made his money doing the managing, doing the announcing. It all revolved around his speech. It all revolved around his voice, using his mouth, using his voice. And this robbed him of that. This disease, it could have been any disease. This particular cancer was throat cancer, and it robbed him of his ability to speak. It robbed him of that gift of gab that he made a living off of. The greatest gift of his career, and it was taken away from him. And that, to me, was always the most shameful part about what he had to go through. I had the chance, you know, the very first WrestleMania that I ever attended live. For all the years I've been a fan, it's amazing it took me this long, but I went to my first Mania only in 2012. That was WrestleMania 28, Rock vs. Cena, in Miami. And that was the last year that they had this Wrestle Reunion event. Wrestle Reunion ended up getting replaced basically by WrestleCon. It was like Wrestle Reunion 7. Because everybody came to wherever WrestleMania was, right? They all descended upon the host city of WrestleMania. You had all these conventions and independent shows and all these other events. And Bobby Heenan was going to be one of the people making an appearance, a signing appearance at Wrestle Reunion 7. And we were already thinking about going. I said, we have to make sure that we go see Bobby. And I remember going to the show, and I saw him, and he everywhere he went, he had his wife with him. And I remember seeing him in person at first, and it takes you aback to see his appearance. Everything that he had been through visually, when you look at him and his mouth and everything, it took me a second. It was like, wow. It kind of knocked you back a little bit. But then you realize that's fucking Bobby Heenan over there. And I was wearing a t-shirt that said, that's not fair to Flair. Because I think Barbershop Window had a shirt, you know, made at one point like that. And I just thought, it was a play off the Rumble 92 commentary. I said, I gotta buy that. I didn't know that I would be seeing Bobby eventually, so I wore it. And as soon as I walked over to the table, he took one look at the shirt and he starts pointing at it. And he's looking over at his wife. He's like, hey, take a look at this. And I thought that was pretty cool. And I had the chance to just talk to him just briefly for a few minutes, took a picture with him and everything. And for me, that was a big thrill because he was always a favorite of mine. And so that was great that I had the chance to meet him during that event. I will say one last word on this. This happened probably last year, right? Or a couple of years ago, maybe. Actually, no, it was a little bit before that. Because Bobby died 3 years ago. So this would have been the year before he died. So about 4 years ago now. If you remember the whole controversy about Bobby on Twitter, there was a Bobby Heenan imposter on Twitter the year before he passed away. And it's even more sinister than that because I assume it was the same person. There was a fake account for Bobby's wife that actually predated the Bobby Heenan account. And this person was masquerading on Twitter as Bobby's wife, unbeknownst to people, undetected and unbeknownst. And when the Bobby Heenan account suddenly appeared, it seemed like his wife was sort of endorsing it. Other wrestlers came out and endorsed it. And Twitter gave the account a blue check mark. And usually when you get a blue check mark, you would think that, okay, it's been verified that this is actually the person. So when the Bobby Heenan account got it, it was like real Bobby Heenan, and it got a check mark, everybody got all excited because holy shit, after all these years, Bobby Heenan is on Twitter. How fucking great is this? And he would tweet and answer people's questions, and he was talking about the current roster and praising Kevin Owens and all these people. And there was absolutely nothing that would lead you to believe that it was not Bobby Heenan, right? It was a verified account. He wasn't posting kind of weird stuff. It seemed like it was endorsed by all the people who would know him and his wife. And unfortunately, not only was it not him, Bobby's wife had no idea that there was an account for him. She had no idea that it was an account for her. Somebody tipped her off, and she was like desperately trying to get the word out to people saying, it's not me, it's not Bobby. Bobby is not on social media. He is not on Twitter. And there were a lot of very disappointed people to find that. I was one of them to find out that it was not. And then I was angry too. I was very angry because there were people who mailed letters to him of support and stuff. Because, you know, I think it seemed like his wife had put an address. If you want to send fan mail to Bobby, here's the address. And people would send letters to him talking, you know, about how big of a fan they were and, I know everything you went through with the cancer. I just want to let you know that, you know, you've got your supporters here and I'm a big fan of yours. And, you know, people sent letters in to some random address that was not Bobby Heenan's address. I mean, just think, how sick in the brain do you need to be to do something like that? What possesses a human being to do something like that? Unless they're sick in the fucking brain. It's pathetic. It really is pathetic that people would do that. But it was easy to buy into because you would think, okay, Bobby is having these issues. He can't speak, but he can tweet. How great would it be to get him on Twitter? It would have been the perfect outlet for him. But it wasn't him. And he passed away the following year. And I think there were many more contributions he could have made in various ways to wrestling and WWE and doing different projects and stuff on the network and stuff that unfortunately we never got to see, we never got to hear, but it doesn't change the fact that he will go down as the greatest of all time, regardless of what anybody says. I think even Jim Cornette, some people would say, nah, Jim Cornette's the best manager. I think Cornette himself has said, Bobby's number one, I'm number two. You don't get too much debate from people when you call him the best. And being a manager is sort of a lost art in wrestling. It has been brought back. We have a lot of managers back on TV now, but it's not the same. It was an art form back then. Some managers really were the managers for the talent and they would book their travel and kind of look after them. And it's not the same. You don't have that these days. But Bobby was the absolute best. Let's take some mailbag questions. You can email them to me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you do write in. Chase from Rapid City, South Dakota. WrestleMania weekend is a huge wrestling hub for every promotion. Do you think AEW should throw their hat in the ring and do a live event style show during WrestleMania weekend, similar to the New Japan Ring of Honor Supercard, where they do it on the night of the WWE Hall of Fame show? I don't think so. I think it's a crowded enough weekend as it is. I don't think they're looking to infringe on their turf. In fact, I think last year, if I'm remembering, I think the AEW folks, the Bucks or whoever, came out and said they were intentionally not going to run that weekend. They were going to let them have the weekend to themselves. There's enough shows going on as it is that weekend. I don't think you need to shoehorn an AEW event in there. I think it's better to just kind of leave that weekend alone and run unopposed with nothing else going on and keep all the focus on you on a different weekend. Chase has one more question. Do you think the U.S. would allow fans back into the arenas if they could follow what Japan is doing? No cheering, only clapping. I feel like it could work, but in a very small venue like Full Sail. Well, I don't know. I mean, that completely depends on the state. It completely depends. I mean, things here are definitely not in check. And until they can get into check, if they allow fans back in for wrestling events, it'll be a certain capacity, but you might be able to get 20 or 30% capacity in one state, but another state is still having too big of an outbreak and you can't have any people. But if they can find a state where it's safe to run, yeah, I think you can get 10, 20%. That's kind of what AEW is working towards right now. But they're not at the point yet where you're going to have 50% like you're seeing at these New Japan shows. Just two different places. But that, I think, is the goal for them to work up to that point. You'll have fans back in the building very soon. It's like I said earlier, AEW is already doing it slowly, but they're doing it. New Japan has fans back in their buildings. Vince McMahon is not going to let too much more time go by before he gets people back into his events, because if they're doing it, then we should be able to do it. So they got the Thunderdome contract through the end of October. I don't know if they renew it for, you know, one more cycle, or it could be early November. It could be as soon as early November before we start seeing fans back in buildings. There's talk that they're looking into potential outdoor venues in certain states. Now, I don't know how that's going to work because we're heading into the fall and the winter. So if they're looking at outdoor venues, then they've got to be looking at an outdoor venue on the West Coast, I would imagine. So, but the point is they're looking. And it's only a matter of time before they find something. Andrew from Rochester, Minnesota. During the retribution attacks over the past few months, we've seen upwards of 24 individuals involved. Obviously, WWE will not be adding 25 names to the Raw roster and will more likely have around 7 or so once the members are revealed. We know that Vince wants to own everything. I would imagine their retribution cannot be trademarked. However, WWE did trademark the word Justice, spelled J-U-S-T-U-S. Do you think the progression of the retribution storyline will see many of the masked individuals desert the group until it is down to the names that we've heard rumored, like Dio Madden, Mia Yim, who then start referring to themselves as Justice, since everyone else abandoned the cause, leaving just us? That is a clever idea. I don't know about already having Retribution members leaving and splintering off, unless they start kicking people out. But that trademark that you're referring to, the Justice trademark, was filed on July 29th. That is the same day WWE filed trademarks for the Hurt Business. So they filed it on the 29th of July, and it really hasn't been talked about since, nor has it been mentioned on TV. So obviously they registered it, they're saving it for something. I think it could be used in some form for Retribution. It could just be another name or another word they start using soon, but I hadn't put that together, actually. So I'm glad you brought that up. I had forgotten about that trademark. But yeah, the word Justice, J-U-S-T-U-S, is how they spelled it. We'll see if that plays into this Retribution stuff in the weeks to come. Dave Taylor, not to be confused with Squire Dave Taylor from WCW. This is Dave Taylor from Annapolis, Maryland. I was watching the latest NXT UK episode where the stars picked their favorite matches since they are, or they were, up until now anyway, they were unable to produce any live content for their show. Ridge Holland chose the October 8, 1985 primetime wrestling match between Bret the Hitman Hart and the Dynamite Kid. During the match, Gorilla Monsoon and Lord Alfred Hayes mentioned that WWE would be giving away a Rolls Royce at an upcoming pay-per-view. I found out that a fan competition was held during the Wrestling Classic, where one lucky fan won the car. Do you remember this? I remember hearing about this, yes. I remember hearing about this and what it was upon further inspection. It was a gimmick to try to get more people just to watch the Wrestling Classic, which was a big, I don't know if it was on pay-per-view, or it was like a big pay-per-view event back in 85. Or maybe it was closed circuit, but it was a big event. They wanted more people to tune in. They wanted to entice more people to watch. And it's not unlike the way they gave away a house on the first In Your House pay-per-view in 95. Only here they gave away a Rolls Royce. They actually gave away a Rolls Royce. The guy who won it was a truck driver from Illinois. And if I remember the segment where they announced the winner, I think the fans booed the hell out of it. I wonder if that would make them a smart crowd back in 1985. Since some people seem to think the fans shitting on everything these days makes them smarks. They're smart fans. In this case, they were smart. They were smart enough to know the segment was probably dog shit, which is why they booed it. That, plus they didn't win the car. So, if you had entered a contest and you didn't win, you wouldn't be very happy either. Why am I going to cheer that this guy won a Rolls Royce? Where's my car? Neil from Chicago. How would you feel if Randy Orton did not go the predictable route of facing Edge at WrestleMania next year, but instead faces The Fiend? There is a history between the two, and I like the idea of Bray getting his revenge in back-to-back WrestleManias. Oh God, no, is my first response. Don't put that evil on me. The fact that you would even bring it up and that I would even feature it here actually probably wasn't a very smart move on my part. I don't even want to plant the seed for that idea. Their WrestleMania match was god-awful. I was there for it. That WrestleMania match sucked. I have no interest in seeing that match again at WrestleMania. And Bray already got his revenge. I'm not even sure. Why is there a need for revenge? Bray got his revenge. He beat Randy Orton in their House of Horrors match a month later. So there's no need for him to get revenge on Randy Orton. Or any of us. Jerome in Sin City, USA. Eddie Guerrero's win over Brock Lesnar was one of the best moments, and I was wondering why this was not a WrestleMania match. The win would have been so much bigger on that stage. Well, I have to assume the reason that it wasn't a WrestleMania match is because the match that they had already been teasing for WrestleMania months earlier was Goldberg and Brock Lesnar. Goldberg and Brock Lesnar was a much bigger match than Brock Lesnar against Eddie Guerrero. The Eddie Guerrero match was a better match, but if you're looking at those two matches on paper side by side and you're the booker or you're the promoter and you got WrestleMania 20 coming up in Madison Square Garden, what match are you doing? The answer is Brock and Goldberg. They teased that match going back as far as the Survivor Series. They had a backstage segment. I think both guys had championships. Remember the face-to-face between Brock and Goldberg? So they had already been planning for that match months earlier. Once they got wind that Brock was leaving, I assume that's why they took the belt off of him. But they were still able to do the match with him and Goldberg, because that was the bigger match. But I agree. Eddie getting that moment at the end of a big WrestleMania match, like a main event or a co-main event, that would have been huge. But even where they did it at the Cow Palace out there, he had family in the crowd. It was a big moment at the Cow Palace too. Nick from Florida, I was reminded of all the scandals that WWE has dealt with over the decades. While I have seen some articles suggest that these scandals hurt their finances at the time, I have never seen clear data to confirm this. For example, Vince McMahon's steroid trial does not seem to have directly impacted their income during those years. If anything, it seemed that Hulk Hogan leaving for WCW in 1993 was the bigger issue. Well, he didn't leave for WCW in 93. He left to go film Thunder in Paradise and do movies. And it wasn't until Ric Flair told Eric Bischoff, hey, you know, you should talk to Hulk. You might be able to get him in. And then in 94, they met with Hogan on the set. They pulled off the deal, and in June of 94, he got himself a ticker tape parade. But yeah, that's not why he left WWF in 93. But anyway, he wants to know, did any of the WWF scandals ever directly hurt its bottom line? I would say directly, that I'm aware of directly, no. I don't know that you can point to any one scandal and say this is what sunk the company at that time. This is the reason why business went way down. There are things you can point to, like the Stone Cold heel turn, that directly had a negative impact on business. Unless you consider that a scandal, that's not a scandal. During those low periods, I don't think there were many people who stopped watching WWE because of the steroid trial. They were probably aware of it. I know that was major news. Even the sex scandals and the accusations in 92 about that. People, I think some people knew, but a lot of people probably didn't even have any idea that that was going on. It would have been a much bigger story in today's day and age because you have social media, easier access to news. So I think part of the problem is some people just didn't know some of this stuff was going on. The steroid trial, probably they did, but these other scandals, they may not have even known about them. But if people stopped watching and stopped buying tickets back then, you know, it was because they didn't like the product that was being offered or because a lot of the big stars left to go to WCW. You know, 1992 is a favorite year of mine, but with the heat coming down on Vince from the federal government on the steroid stuff, and I think by that point, Dr. Zahorian, the steroid doctor, was already in jail, we saw a lot of changing physiques. We saw a lot of incredibly shrinking wrestlers that year. And all of a sudden, these larger-than-life bodies, these cartoon-like characters, they didn't look so cartoon-like anymore. They looked like mere mortals. They looked like regular people that had, you know, that happened to have some big muscles. And Vince fired the Ultimate Warrior. He fired the British Bulldog. You can say that those things all affected business, and that came as a result of maybe the larger scandal, but to make the direct connection, I don't know that you can. They indirectly, how about that? They indirectly impacted the business. But I don't think you can draw like a straight line from one to the other. I don't think you can do that. And the other thing also is, you talk about seeing numbers and figures and dollar amounts and stuff like that, but yeah, that stuff wasn't as easily accessible back then. It was a private company. They didn't go public until 1999. Now, stuff like that would leak all the time to the dirt sheets. Meltzer always had the numbers and the attendances and stuff. And I don't know that anybody is really debating him on the numbers. A lot of wrestlers back then would also share numbers in terms of like what they were making and stuff. That's why they would read the Observer back then and the Torch. But especially the Observer, because they wanted to know, am I getting a fair shake? Should I be asking for more money? Is something going on here? Because they didn't tell the wrestlers anything back then. They didn't know shit. They were in the dark about all this stuff. They're being worked to the bone, traveling 300 days a year, maybe making what they think is good money, but then they read in the Observer that so-and-so just signed, and he's not even a bigger star, but he's making more money than me. That's where the newsletters became really useful for a lot of wrestlers and a lot of people back then. To try to figure out, am I getting screwed here? Am I getting a fair shake or not with what I'm making? And that's why people would leak stuff. But those numbers, you couldn't just bring them up in an internet search back then. It's a private company. Couldn't go on Google. There was no Google. I mean, how are you going to search for that stuff? So, but, you know, again, I look at that period and I look at the product overall, even their tag team division. Their tag team division that year, you know, wasn't as strong as they used to be. They lost a lot of talent. Now, I would gladly take that tag team division over the one we have today in WWE. But there were a lot of reasons why business fell off. And why they were running Monday Night Raw tapings for a while out of high school gyms. Like, literally, you'd be watching Raw, and you could tell it wasn't a big crowd, it wasn't a big building. You could see sometimes the basketball hoops and the brick wall in the background. Business was booming, they wouldn't be running small buildings like that, but that's what they were going through back then. If you have questions for the mailbag, email me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. And you'll note that I was plugging ExpressVPN earlier. With the pandemic and everything, there were some sponsors who left. And I'm really happy that we got them back in the fold for a new campaign. And I meant what I said. I have to check when my subscription expires. I think it expires in about a month or two. I'm not using it every day, but it has come in very useful for me in various situations. Even content, you know, that maybe... I'll give you one example. There was a movie that somebody told me to watch on Netflix. Actually, it might have been the whole New Jack City thing when I brought that up, which I still haven't watched. I have a link to it. I'm going to watch it, I promise. I'm going to try to watch it, in fact, this week. But I went on Netflix and I couldn't find it. Well, Netflix rotates stuff out. And I was like, oh man, that sucks. But then someone told me, like, oh, it's on Netflix in like Germany or something. And they're like, well, you could just use a VPN to access it. And I was like, I've never tried that before. Let me try it. And sure enough, like, you connect to a server in another country, and different countries have their own version of Netflix. And they had stuff that we didn't have here in America, and vice versa, you know, because they rotate content out. Blew me away. It's like, this is awesome. And I had no idea. But there's a lot of reasons to use a VPN, a lot of security reasons to be using a VPN when you're doing your internet searching and stuff. Probably a lot of people working from home are using a VPN right now to remote into your workstations. I know I am. But I meant what I said. You know, it is, if not the best, certainly one of the best services out there. And if you use that link, you're going to be helping the podcast out a lot, because then we'll be able to work together even longer. So if you're thinking about it, if it sounds like something that would be of interest to you, if you've never used a VPN before, seriously, use that link, expressvpn.com/solomonster. The offer is for the 1-year package, which you get 3 free months. And I think you'll find it very useful for a lot of different reasons. You can find a lot of different reasons to find VPNs useful. Everyone has their own reasons for using VPNs. But if you use that link, you're going to help out the podcast a lot. So very happy to have them back on board. Very happy to have you all on board. I hope you'll join me on Wednesday live after Dynamite. I'll be live on YouTube. We have a lot of content coming up this week, because next Sunday is the pay-per-view. It's Clash of Champions. So Wednesday night, live on YouTube after Dynamite. The plan is for me to go live on YouTube Thursday afternoon, maybe around 1 o'clock, maybe. I'll let you guys know on Twitter. But I'll be going live for Clash of Champions predictions. So if you want my predictions, if you want to write in with the super chats, or try calling in, give me your predictions, that's going to be the time to join me on Thursday, live on YouTube. And then next Sunday, I'll be back with episode 671. And Sunday night, live on YouTube again for the full Clash of Champions recap. So you're going to get a lot of Solomonster over these next 7 days. I want to end September the way we ended August. August was the biggest month ever. I'd like for September to, if it doesn't top August, I want to be nipping at its heels. So hopefully you'll join me. Be well, stay safe, have yourselves a great week, and I will see you back here for 671 next Sunday. Until then, take care, guys.
The Solomonster sounds off.
This is the same Lana, by the way, who admitted this week that she and Rusev had sex on top of the tank that Rusev rode out to the ring at WrestleMania 31. Anybody can make a claim like that, really. Look, I was at that WrestleMania. I could sit here and tell you that I had sex on top of that same tank that weekend with a lady friend. And guess what? You'd have no way to prove me wrong.
Oh my God.
It's
Now you're all going to be wondering. Chew on that.
The Solomonster Sounds Off, available wherever you hear podcasts, including iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spotify, and now Pandora.
Want more content?
Visit youtube.com/thesolomonster for Sound Off extras and more. And follow the Solomonster on Twitter at Solomonster.
Solomonster.
Put that cigarette out.
Solomonster Sounds Off.